make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about day number two of the voter suppression trial. Yes, the law is still in effect. And wow, what a wonderful job the Commonwealth has done in getting out those free voter IDs. They're saying somewhere like 750,000 people without an ID. I think they said they've gotten 17,000 out. These are legally registered voters, but that's wow. It's good work. Good work. Also going to talk about no nuclear option. Evidently a deal was made. There is going to be someone to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Also someone's going to head up the Department of Labor. They're going to see the National Labor Relations Board. Fully stocked and doing what it's supposed to do, its job. So it's going to be interesting to see the next couple of days what spin comes out of the GOME, because it's widely viewed that this is an absolute and total capitulation by the Republicans, because they've realized that, oh, by the way, we've basically stalled, gridlocked, and delayed everything. We've held up the system. And maybe people are waking up to that reality, that the reason government isn't working as it should is because you've got obstructionists in the Senate. You've got a recalcitrant Republican Party. You've got an infection, if you will, of radical ideologues who have infected the Republican Party and have really mucked up our system. And you know what? Election season's coming around the corner. They want to hold on to power. Seems reasonable to me. I'm also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Great to be back in the studio. Day two back in the studio after more than a month on the road. I'm kind of missing the road, to be honest with you. Reminded me of driving for a living. I used to love driving a truck. It was something that you just... You can't explain. You get in, you go, you've got miles ahead of you. Mind-clearing focus. I miss that. I do. But back in the studio for day number two until we head out once again, which I'm sure coming up soon. If you missed any of the tour, peoplestourforamerica.com, ricksmithshow.com, that's where you can go to find out about the tour if you missed any of it. So under the heading of austerity's just not working, New York Times had a piece that talked about the OECD study that came out today, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They came out with a study today on the impact, the social impact of European economics, the crisis that's going on, and the fact that, well, probably not going to change anytime soon because of bad policy. And they point out that joblessness is probably going to go up in Europe, in Spain, and in Greece, and in Italy. Because right now, in Spain and in Greece, you're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 28% unemployment. About 12.5% in Italy, 11% in France is what they're saying by the end of 2014, according to their forecast. What they're saying is, look, you know, the people who are struggling the most, the young people who are getting out of college with nowhere to go, and low-skilled workers who, well, they didn't go to college, they don't have the skills, nothing there. Those jobs have gone to lower-wage countries. And what's interesting to me is you look at Germany, where they've said, you know what, the unemployment for the youth in the country, it's the biggest challenge for the Germans right now, according to Angela Merkel. France, they've said that they're going to try and reduce unemployment, maybe do something, you know. What I found interesting is one of the economists from Capital Economics, she said that it's what they should be doing is easing the austerity. Because, look, just a thought here. And look, I'm not an economist. You know, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box. But if people have jobs, and I'll quote sainted Ronald Reagan, who said the best anti-poverty program is a job. Even if it is government as employer of last resort, it's still a job. It's still getting money into people's pockets and the economic engine moving. That whole prime the pump thing that the radical right in this country have tried to discredit, it actually works. And what this article talked about is, you know, in these countries that they looked at, in these OECD countries, they are saying that government should be spending some money on helping people find jobs, job training, job searches, while what's actually happened is you've seen a massive cut in the programs that help those people who are struggling. Now, there's some hope. I mean, France and Germany, they're going to try. Italy, the new government there, going to try some programs to increase jobs. But what do you hear from the right? Well, we need tax cuts. That's all you hear from the business and the wealth community. We need tax cuts, and we need to reduce labor costs to boost employment. And this is something we're hearing right here at home. And we've been hearing it since, well, forever. If we could just get rid of that pesky minimum wage, if we could just get rid of those pesky regulations, you know, that health and safety, you know, that overtime, if we had more flexibility. And someone sent me this clip of the Koch Foundation. Charles Koch evidently launched last week a $200,000 media campaign in Wichita, Kansas. And the point is again, you know, the whole idea is to destroy the minimum wage and to promote this idea that, well, you're part of the 1%. Did you know that? You, Mr. Burger Flipper, you're part of the 1%. You're it. You got, listen to this ad. Or don't.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over $34,000 a year, you are one of the wealthiest 1%. In the world. That is the power of economic freedom. People in the most economically free countries earn, on average, over 8 times more than people in the least free. The poor earn 10 times as much. People in the most free countries have better protected civil rights, less unemployment, and the average person lives almost 20 years longer. Across the board, we see a strong relationship between economic freedom people's quality of life. The United States used to be a world leader in economic freedom, but our ranking fell, and it's projected to decline even further. The choice is ours. Let's rise again. The Charles Koch Foundation. Realize the potential of freedom.
Realize the potential of freedom. You know, freedom from a decent wage, freedom from health care, freedom from a retirement, freedom from anything that built the middle class. And what they talk about economic freedom, what they're talking about is more for me as the Koch brothers, and, well, screw you. Now, the report that they cite is the Fraser Institute report, which is funded by the Koch brothers. It's kind of like the Bush justification for going into Iraq, where he cites his own speech as justification for going into Iraq. The report that they cite, this Fraser Institute report, ranks Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Switzerland, and Chile ahead of the U.S. What it fails to point out, those are countries that all have government-run health care. Yeah, something the Koch brothers not thrilled with. In fact, vehemently oppose. And what I find interesting is you get these billionaires, the people who are on the Bush Wall of Freedom, who are telling, and it reminds me of Gina Reinhart. How many people remember Gina Reinhart, the billionaire heiress from Australia, who made her money the old-fashioned way? She grabbed it on the way out of the birth canal, saying that we should do away with the minimum wage because there are people in Africa willing to work for $2 a day. And that if you're poor, you're just lazy and stupid, and you smoke and drink too much, and you socialize too much, you should be working every day, $2 a day. I mean, I look at this, and he threw $200,000 at just throwing this ad out there. $200,000 to him is nothing. It's what you've got in your lint drawer right now. It's what's in the cushions between your couch. It's what fell down on the floor when you went through the drive-thru at the fast food joint. That's what it means to him. But what it means in media is now that message is magnified. And what they're telling us is, well, you know, we're part of the 1%. I make $34,000 a year. I'm globally one of the 1%. And a couple of messages. One, trying to murky the waters of him being truly the 1%. Answer me this. If $34,000 a year is globally part of the 1%, where does the $40 billion Koch brother go? What percent is he in? What strata is he in? What rarefied air do we find him in? And I love that framing. I mean, you got to give them credit. They're masterful at manipulation, masterful at coming up with these $34,000 global, you're 1%. And it's because of your economic freedom, which is ridiculous. It's because we've got stable laws. It's because we have a minimum wage structure, even as low as it is, should be much higher. It's because we have an education system, an infrastructure. It's because of a whole bunch of things. Economic freedom, a nice concept. Not quite so sure that that's the point. But that's really not the point of the ad, is it? It's really kind of a chest thumper.
Now we're on the rise.
Again. Must be nice to be rich and to just throw the money out there. And how many people have seen these television ads, the value people? Another billionaire pet project to kind of push us in the direction that they think we should be. I fear that someday, and you know, I've often joked that, you know, maybe we should give the radical right wing what they want, give them the free market that they want, just so the rest of us would see how horrible it is. But for them, it would never be that horrible. They know what they're peddling. They know what the end result is. And the end result, more for them. And screw you. And me. And this whole push is to get us to start thinking, okay, well, if we got rid of the minimum wage, we could solve our unemployment problems. And I've been saying for the longest time, do that. We could pay everybody a buck an hour. We'd have nobody unemployed. In fact, people like the McDonald's thing we talked about yesterday. People would be working 2, 3, 4, 10. They'd be working 24/7 until they just drop dead because, well, they wouldn't have health care either. Is that the world we want? Is that where we want to live in? Is that the vision that you have for your children? I know it's not the vision I've got for mine, which is why this ad, repulsive. But what else would you expect from the billionaires of Bush? Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus joined fast food and retail workers and their supporters in Milwaukee on Monday to speak out against wage theft and to urge a pay raise for these workers. U.S. Representatives Keith Ellison, Gwen Moore, and Danny Davis appeared in Milwaukee in support of the Raise Up Milwaukee campaign. They're urging the rest of Congress to focus on raising pay and bringing good jobs to cities like Milwaukee. Community supporters of the workers, including clergy, joined Monday's action in Milwaukee. Employers are increasingly stealing wages by forcing workers to work off the clock, denying them overtime pay, or forcing them to use fee-laden pay cards to get paid. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus are traveling the country this summer, highlighting income inequality and the struggle to raise wages and benefit standards for low-wage workers. When striking Smithsonian federally contracted workers brought their protest to the home of Smithsonian Secretary Wayne Clough, he told them they need to talk to their employers, not the museum that contracts with those employers. But the Smithsonian and other federal entities that contract this work out have the power to set standards. Here's part of the exchange the Smithsonian Secretary had with the low-wage federally contracted workers at the door of his home.
We're trying to
U.S. Steel plans to force a vote on workers at a plant in Ontario. Nearly 1,000 workers at the plant have been locked out by the company since April. Jesse Russell reports.
U.S. Steel has asked the government to intervene and make what it calls a final contract vote happen. The move comes only a week after the government chose to not extend employment insurance to the locked-out workers. The United Steelworkers had argued that part of the reason for the lockout was due to Ottawa's failure to enforce promises made to workers by U.S. Steel when it bought out Stelco 6 years ago. The local has claimed that U.S. Steel introduced a contract it knew the union would be unable to accept, so it could lock out the workers and idle a Canadian plant, thereby increasing production at plants elsewhere. The most recent contract offer from U.S. Steel had been rejected by the U.S. bargaining team on July 12th.
U.S. Airways workers are protesting that they are mired in poverty wages while executive pay at the airline soars. U.S. Airways is merging with American Airlines. Executives want even more money when the merger happens. SEIU 32BJ President Hector Figueroa says it's an unfair system that rewards a few at the top at the expense of the worker bees. The workers recently took their complaints to a U.S. Airways shareholders meeting in New York City. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
So yesterday, House Majority Policy Committee Chairman David Reed announced that he had planned his committee to do a visiting tour. He's going to visit places around the Commonwealth, you know, where them poors live. You know, see how lazy or stupid or shiftless they are? You know, those poors. What he's calling it Empowering Opportunities, Gateways Out of Poverty. And my first thought when I saw this was, I wonder if he actually knows any poor people. I mean, just a thought. Because if you look at all the things that they've done, it's to make things worse. You know, like I said last night, you want to help people in poverty? Raise the minimum wage. You want to help people in poverty? Get them health care. You want to help people in poverty? Fund education. You want to help people in poverty? Stop degrading them. Just a couple of quick thoughts from someone who, at one point in his life, found himself in poverty. Just a thought. Anyway, here to help talk a little bit about this, I've got Scott Conklin, Pennsylvania State Representative. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, what's this? There's poverty in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, in fact, something like 1.5 million of our fellow Pennsylvanians find themselves, about 12% of the population live below the poverty line, which they put at about $23,000 for a family of four.
Well, I'll tell you, Rick, probably why that came about is, you know, 3 years ago when the House controlled the controlled the House was controlled by the Democrats and Rendell was the governor. Pennsylvania ranked number 7th in the nation for job creation. 3 years under Republican rule, we ranked number 47th. Maybe since we've dropped down 40 spaces, the Republicans finally figured out, Dave Reed and Terzide and Corbett probably figured out there's those poor people out there and they're really bringing down the numbers. In fact, Pennsylvania last month, we did make number 1. We lost more jobs in the state of Pennsylvania than any other state in the nation. So, hey, Tom Corbett, you know, the Republican Policy Committee, you finally made number 1 somewhere. But I'm glad to find out they finally realized there may be folks in poverty.
Well, I mean, they're making a lot of them, so maybe they can find some. And, you know, as I'm reading through this, and I'm not quite sure what it was, which is why I asked you, maybe you know, because it was a listening tour. They're going to try and find poor people. Yeah, we reached out to a couple of groups across the state who work with poverty issues. They hadn't heard anything from Mr. Reed's committee. They know where the poor people are.
Well, maybe they should visit those 20,000 school teachers that lost their job under the budget. That would probably be a really good place to start. Maybe talk to some of their families, or maybe go to Philadelphia where they patted themselves on the back because, oh, on Monday when we finally finished the budget, and again, the Corbett will tell you, no, he finished the budget. This wasn't necessary. Why did we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to send all the legislative body back to do the fiscal note, which, by the way, that's the part that pays the bills if it wasn't necessary. But if maybe you could go to Philadelphia where they're laying off another 3,700 teachers, they're getting rid of things such as, oh, sports and music and the arts, maybe you can find some of those poor people there if they really want to go out and find them.
Yeah, well, and it's even worse than that. I mean, they're getting rid of books and desks and water fountains. And, you know, I was reading the contract proposal from the school district there. They want to do away with filing cabinets and telephones and doors. I'm going, really?
Well, I think what they first have to do is maybe put down their glass of $1,000 bottle wine they're drinking and their cheese and their little cribbit crackers they have, and maybe they should come on out on the street and even visit people who work for minimum wage that have no insurance. By the way, we tried a couple times to put in the health care that would actually employ 40,000 more people, but they stopped that as well. I think it's good they're doing this poverty tour. I think they're probably going to start out at the Duquesne Club in Pittsburgh, maybe up through the Erie Yacht Club, come down through the nice, you know, Hershey Country Club, and then maybe get somewhere out, you know, at Philadelphia, one of the finer country clubs out there, and maybe they could get together and have a discussion to see if they really are poor people out there or not.
Well, there are. In all of those places, there are poor people. You know, they're the poor people who serve them. You know, if you remember that video that caught Mitt Romney talking about the 47% and really, you know, torpedoed his campaign. The people that were serving him as they're talking about the 47%, those are the people who are living in poverty and were completely invisible to those people in the room.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret. One of the places we go and we have lunch every so often, the waitress told us one day that she really likes it's normally folks I don't want to say the establishment because they do frequent it, but the waitress told us one day she really appreciates that when the Democrats come over because there was a table full of some of the folks you may have mentioned that there were about 8 of them. She got a $3 tip and we weren't even thinking about it. Our meal was like $15 and we gave her $21 for 2 of us. She told us how nice it was. She appreciated when the Democrats stepped in.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, I'm not going to be mean.
And we're not even going to bring up the egg episode in downtown Harrisburg.
Now you got to tell me, what's the egg episode?
Oh, you didn't hear Corbett's appointee to the Department of Health got upset and refused to pay his bill because he said the egg wasn't fresh enough.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't get into that, but no, I'm much like you, and I hated to joke about it, but when they talked about they were actually going to go out and discuss whether there was poverty, it was the most ridiculous press conference I've ever heard in my life. I was astounded by how these individuals think. They were so far out of touch with mainstream. I mean, they're heading in the wrong direction. They've done nothing to create jobs in Pennsylvania. All we've done is that, for your listening audience who may not know, the reason we had to go back into Harrisburg, when they did the fiscal note, which, by the way, was after the budget was signed.
Right.
The fiscal note is part of the budget. It's sort of like getting a new kitchen and your contractor saying that sink and the refrigerator and the stove and the drawers weren't included in the kitchen, but your kitchen was done. You'd look at them and say, no, no, you better finish it up. Well, we used to do the fiscal note first, then we pass the budget. Well, under the new way, we do the budget, then we pass the fiscal note. But what they did was they had the fiscal note, which is what we pay the bills with, and they put a blind amendment in. In fact, it was not only a blind amendment, they didn't even put the text up for the people to read what the amendment was. Of course, we as Democrats, as foolish Democrats, we wanted to read what it was, but they wouldn't put the text up, so it voted party lines. Republicans all voted yes. The Democrats voted no.
Whoa! Stop! Come on, that can't be. They wouldn't even let you read it.
No, there was no text in it whatsoever. They never put the text up. They voted it through. Lo and behold, hidden in page somewhere around 23, 24, was the ability to allow payday lending in Pennsylvania, to allow predatory lending where folks can get, starting out at 22%, and I can introduce you to people that have already paid 120% interest on their loan. Thank goodness the Senate caught it, stripped it back out again, and that's the reason we had to go back to Harrisburg on Monday, because good, transparent folks for the people tried to put in payday lending. And who uses payday lending? The poor.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a good thing. This is the kind of stuff that Dave Reed's going to do. He's going to help the poor with these kind of great programs.
Wait a minute. I misread what they did. The reason they did that is that they figured all the poor would go use the payday lending, and that's where they would wait to meet them.
See?
They would finally find out the working poor that would go out and have to use a payday lending, and their theory is that they'd all sit at these establishments and wait for them to come in, and they could talk to them about being poor.
Yeah, see? And get them a loan and help them out.
In all honesty, I've never seen anything way. I mean, think about this. A half dozen things they've done have been found unconstitutional, but the audacity to try to slide something into a bill. I mean, this is what I went to Harrisburg for in 2006, and we tried to stop. They try to slide something in a bill, and I don't know if the listeners can get their head around this. They put an amendment on a fiscal note, which, by the way, had nothing to do with putting money into the budget, that did not have text in it for anybody to read. They voted it through. They would have never have done that under the Democratic control. In fact, we would never have done that. They voted it through, and they put predatory lending in Pennsylvania. And if it wasn't for the Senate catching it and stripping it back out again, you would have predatory lending in Pennsylvania today. And that's the reason we had to go back to Harrisburg, which, by the way, taxpayers, we cost you a lot of money for us all to go back to Harrisburg on Monday to pay us to go back down there to pass something that should have been passed the first time.
And just so that they could get that one thing. And so did they, I guess the question I have is, did they get to read it? I mean, this blind amendment, basically a blank check, if you will. Did the Republicans at least read it? I mean, I understand I understand authoritarian rule. I understand dictatorship. I don't want the opposition to know anything. I'm going to keep the opposition in the blind, in the closet, in the dark, whatever. But did they at least read it? Did they at least know what they voted for?
Well, not a lot of my Republican colleagues weren't aware, but remember, Verb clearly stated that we're not paid to think. We're just paid to vote. If you remember, he had that press conference during the budget where he was blaming the 91 Democrats from stopping the 112 Republicans from getting 102 votes for transportation.
Right.
But when he made the comment that the Democrats aren't paid to think, they're paid to show up and vote.
Wow.
Nice. I mean, this is what we're dealing with. It's a total disrespect for the other side of the aisle. We have individuals that have no respect for the public whatsoever. And if they were on your radio show, I would say it to their face. If you know anything about me, I worked construction 40 years. In fact, I'm wearing my union T-shirt while I'm walking around talking to you. But they have absolutely no respect for the Democratic Party. And all we are is a nuisance to them because we have the audacity to point out when they do something. And in fact, if one of them are listening tonight, they are probably just absolutely beside themselves that we would sit here and make fun of the fact that they're now going out to see if they can find poverty someplace. But it's the truth. I mean, it's almost, if I was one of their members right now, I would be embarrassed by the fact that they're having a press conference to talk about, they're going to go out and talk about people who are poor.
Yeah.
It would embarrass me to death if I was in the Republican Party right now.
As it should. I mean, and I look at this and I go, you know, when I first saw it, I go, this can't be true. This has got to be an Onion story or something, because their policies have caused a lot of the unemployment, a lot of the pain and suffering. They're gutting unemployment. They're stripping, money from social programs, from education, from all of that stuff, made things worse. And then they're going to go and say, oh, we didn't know. Where's the poverty? It's just,
think about what they've done. They got rid of the 46,000 people that were on adult basics when they took over. Those are people that work that needed health care that got on it. Then, to make it even worse, they refused to do what Christie's done and Jindal's done and the rest of them have done and accept the health care. You may not agree with it, but it employs 40,000 people and insures hundreds of thousands of people overnight. They even refused to do that. It's an ideological leveraged body that has totally lost sight on what we're there to do. We are there for strictly to govern individuals with proper policy. Think about what we've done. In 3 years, we've done nothing to create jobs. In fact, it's gone worse. Again, I'm going to bring this up one more time. We went from 7th 3 years ago to 47th in job creation. We lost more jobs in Pennsylvania last month than any other state in the nation. All we hear them talking about is privatizing a liquor store, which, by the way, costs jobs, privatizing a lottery system, which, by the way, will cost jobs and cost us money, and they don't want to do anything with health care. I mean, they have no idea how to govern. All they know how to do is collect huge checks from corporations to get reelected. But when it comes down to helping the people, God love them, they don't know how. They don't know how to do it.
Yeah, I got to be honest, as I was looking at the story on empowering opportunities, the gateways out of poverty, Mr. Reed said that they were going to work on developing and refining ideas for legislation. And for me, my mind goes, okay, well, let's think of all the bad things you've done over the years. Let's think of some more bad ideas. And, you know, privatizing more of the social services, privatizing food stamps, privatizing everything they can. You know, I look at this and I go, you know, it's just more of the same, more bad ideas, more bad policy. Why do we keep beating our head against the wall with these people?
They found a way, to be quite honest with you, and here's where a problem comes in as Democrats, is that we are so concerned with doing everything right. We are so concerned with doing good policy and good public policy that we allow them to blindside us. Their policy is nothing about creating a job. Their policy is nothing about the good of the public. It's not about a neighborhood rebuilding. It's not about creating a job. It's strictly about winning the election. It's about getting money to send out as much propaganda as you can. I mean, when I said, and I see that people hate their school districts, they hate their school districts because we have totally quit funding the school district. We got rid of 20,000 teachers in 3 years. They hate them because they raise taxes. The reason they raise taxes is because we defunded them. So their answer is it? We'll privatize the public schools. We'll give them to the folks. By the way, there isn't one cyber school that passes, and there's only about 20% of the charter schools that are passed. And they're creaming the best kids off. It's a great plan for marketing and making money, but it's not a good plan if you want to create neighborhoods and you want to do something. If they really wanted to do something about poverty, what they would do is they'd go into these neighborhoods and understand that there's no leaders, that there's no men in those neighborhoods. They need to get leaders back in those neighborhoods. They need to do that by creating jobs, by having folks down there that have a job, that they're able to stay there and raise a family. If they really wanted to do something about poverty, they would go into those neighborhoods, which, by the way, they don't walk into for obvious reasons because they're afraid to. And if they would go in and go in and understand exactly what's going on, exactly why these kids are getting in trouble, and stop it, they could change it, but they don't want to do that.
Now, let me ask you this, you know, last line of questioning. Do you think it's that they're ignorant, that they've not been to those neighborhoods, they don't know? Is it that it's their ignorance, that they really don't understand the issue, or is it just purely that they don't really care? And you know, this is just political play, fodder. They're gonna play around the edges, and oh, we're gonna try, and it'll be more of the same. We need the churches to do more. We need faith-based initiatives and all of that nonsense. I guess I'm trying to let you bail them out here a little bit.
Well, I would, and I don't want to bail them out, but they are. They're ignorant of what's going on. They have no concept of what it's like to live in inner city Erie or inner city Pittsburgh or inner city Philadelphia. They don't have a concept of it. They don't have a concept of what it's like to be where I come from, these coal towns, to where there's no jobs and your grandfather was making more money than what your children are going to make. They don't understand it. They really don't understand it. We've redistricted to the point to where they live in these safe little Republican districts. They no longer care about the masses, but at the same time, they have no concept of what it's like to live in some of these neighborhoods, that the children are afraid, that they're scared to go out on the streets, that, you know, the mothers don't know how they're going to feed their children. They don't know what it's like. They don't understand it. And quite frankly, they don't want to learn what it's like, because it's so much easier to tell people, you know, we just live within our means. Parents know best. And that's what people want to hear. Parents want to hear they know better.
Yeah.
And it's great cover for them. But, yeah, I don't want to bail them out. You're right, Rick. They don't understand it. They don't know what it's like to really to be in those neighborhoods.
Sad stuff. And, you know, there's part of me that goes, maybe if they really truly got out and saw some of this, maybe there's a chance for learning. Maybe there's a chance for some experience that maybe they didn't have. But I really don't think they're going to do that. I think you're right. It's going to be the country club tour. It's going to be the corporate board function. It's going to be they'll go to the charities that are well funded by the very well to do that they pat themselves on the back for.
I guarantee you they won't be in the up above State Street in Harrisburg. There's not going to be any policy meetings. I guarantee you there's not going to be a policy meeting in the King Sessing Center in Philadelphia. I guarantee that there's not going to be anyone on the north side just above Pittsburgh. There won't be any meetings there. None. They don't go into those neighborhoods. They don't want to be in those neighborhoods, and they're afraid to go into those neighborhoods. But if they really wanted to see what poverty was like, they should really go up. If they're in Harrisburg listening, they're right now, just go up in the neighborhood at this time of night and just cruise through. And if they really think it's so safe and it's cozy, get out of their car and walk the neighborhoods. Put on their really nice suits and take their nice little beamers up, park along the street. Get out and just walk the streets if they think everything's all right.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, I'm curious, over the weekend, the not guilty verdict. I know you're a big gun supporter, big Second Amendment guy. What were your thoughts of the decision?
I'll tell you what. It's a tough decision. You've lost a life. You have folks that, you know, and I think one of the things, and I have to be, you know, there's everybody on each side of it. It's a tragedy. And one of the problems they had with it, as they clearly put, is that the way the Florida law is put is that's what the jury had to do. I mean, when you break it down, it was a travesty that went through. It breaks everyone's heart that's involved in it. A young man lost his life.
You know what it tells me,
where
Scott?
Where do we go from here?
Yeah, it tells me that everything that I learned as a kid growing up, and you know, everything my grandfather told me was wrong. You know, and I've said this a number of times since being back, that what this decision told me is that I can go start and pick a fight with you, and you can kick the snot out of me, and I can shoot and kill you.
Yeah.
That's what it tells me.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the discussions we're having is that the way the Florida law is done, it was tough for the jury to come up with any other place. Because one of the things I told my wife, I said, the problem is that he was told not to follow that young man. The police, the 911 dispatcher said, don't follow him, don't engage, but he did. But the way the Florida law was, we have a court system, you have to abide by the court system. But again, it goes to the poverty, it goes, you know, to the whole atmosphere we're talking about. Maybe, maybe our good Republican friends can, you know, make a trip to Florida and visit those neighborhoods as well.
Yeah, well, they're on the tour, you know, might as well. If they're using tax dollars, which I'm sure they're going to do quite well, maybe they should at least learn something out of it. Just a thought.
What they'll do is they'll say, you know, we'll fly to Florida to look at this, but we won't fly first class. We'll fly coach. It'll give us an opportunity to see what it's like.
There you go. Scott, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, enjoy. Sorry, I was a bit tongue-in-cheek tonight, but again,
that has been
one of the funniest press conferences I've heard in a long time.
How can you not be given? I mean, that's just pure comic genius right there.
This is Colbert stuff. This is Saturday Night Live skits they make out of this.
Amazing stuff. Scott Conklin, appreciate the time. Pennsylvania State Representative. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Beat up cars, tires, and drummers go crack, boom, bam. ROTK in the USA. ROTK in the USA. ROTK in the USA. Yeah, yeah. Back in the USA.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Representative Jim Hines says it's appalling. He was talking about the money that special interests stuff in the pockets of our lawmakers. It's disgusting, and it opens the possibility of conflicts of interest and corruption, he added. So, naturally, he promptly joined the disgusting system that has turned our Capitol into a wide-open bazaar for buying and selling legislative favors. It's unfortunately the world we live in, the Connecticut Democrat shrugged. Even though Himes is only in his third term, he's become an aggressive trader in this bazaar, heading up fundraising for his fellow Democrats in the U.S. House. Why him? One, as a member of the committee that oversees Wall Street, he can attract campaign cash like honey attracts flies, especially when big banks are lobbying furiously to get exemptions from legislation that restricts some of their destructive profiteering. Two, Himes has proven to be a trusted ally of the wheeler-dealer bankers, supporting their deregulated bills. And three, he's one of them, having been made a millionaire as a Goldman Sachs banker. Republicans are totally in Wall Street's pocket, but Democrats are sinking into it too. With the admirable exception of Representative Maxine Waters and a handful of other Dems who stood with consumers, most Democrats on the committee joined every Republican member in May to do the bank lobby's bidding. 6 days later, Himes' fundraising operation arranged for the 7 freshman Democrats on the committee, each of whom had stood with the bankers, to trek up to the heights of Wall Street for a personal bonding session with the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. Thus are forged the ties that bind. This is Jim Hightower saying, hey, Democrats, don't just deplore this corrupt system. Stand with us to overthrow it. To learn how, go to www.publiccampaign.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
But the fact
Vice
is,
President Cheney,
but,
though, said it's not a Ponzi scheme. You say it is.
Absolutely. If Vice President Cheney or anyone else says that the program that we have in place today
And young people who are paying into that expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age. That is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone says. We know that. The American people know that. But more importantly, those 25 and 30-year-olds know that.
Well, you know, I look at that, and you listen to that statement. Without question, he knows Social Security is not going to be there. Those programs aren't going to be there. Why? Because it's his party. It's the Republican Party who has done everything they can possibly do over the last 70 years to destroy those programs. And, you know, this all turned during the Reagan years. All of this started going straight to pot thanks to the policies of the sainted Ronald Reagan. And now look at where we're at. We've actually got a Republican Party here in Pennsylvania who's going, we're going to go on a poverty tour. I wonder if they'll have T-shirts. I wonder if it'd be like, you know, like a concert tour. I wonder if they'll actually invite poor people. Or will it just be these? I remember a couple, number of years back when they had all the heads of these big charities who were making huge bank. And they still are making huge money. Way too much money to be heading up a non-profit charity. But, you know, having these gala balls and all of this money being spent on raising money, I wonder how much of this is going to be that. When, to me, the solutions are pretty simple. Smart policy, smart investment, a transportation bill to get people back to work, a jobs program to get everyone who wants a job. Even if government has to be the employer of last resort. Yet I'm listening to right-wing radical radio on the way into work today, and they're going on about a bus survey. You know, a survey of, you know, of how to design bus routes. And it was, I gotta be honest, it was well thought out. It was maybe too detailed, but you want that more than just, oh, we're gonna drive down the road, pick kids up. Which is kind of what these idiot doofuses wanted. And the callers go, I'm going to get me a job working for the bus company. Like there's something wrong with working for the bus depot. Is something wrong with driving kids to school? We've got a really screwed up thought process in this country. And again, it goes back to the money. It goes back to the Koch brothers. It goes back to their ilk who have spent not even a lot of their resource convincing us that minimum wage is bad, unemployment's bad, you know, all of these programs that help buoy up the bottom of the economic scale and all the rest of us as well. For me, the first thing to do, you want to raise poverty? You want to get people out of poverty? First thing to do is you set the minimum wage above the poverty line. What'd you say? You do realize that working a 40-hour week at a place, at a fast food place, you're working in poverty. You do get that. And that most people who are living in poverty are working. And you go back to that website I talked about yesterday, that McDonald's and Visa dreamt up, where they admit fully, there's no way in a cold day in hell you're ever going to survive on 40 hours a week working at a McDonald's. It's never going to happen. So you're going to have to go get a second job making just $150 less than your full-time job at McDonald's. So somehow, miraculously, you're going to find time to work 75 hours a week and not have heat because it didn't fund that either. There are so many things we could be doing, but we're not because it's easier to divide us. It's easier to tear things down, and which is what the Republicans have done masterfully. And understand, this whole we're going to go on the poverty tour is not to see what works or what doesn't work. It's to see what's out there so they can destroy it. What lifelines left? What have we left? What stone have we left unturned? What resource, what lifeline have we left there that we can take away? That's what it's about. I guarantee you when they come back, it's going to be about destroying things. It's not going to be about help empowering anything. You know what the empowerment's going to be? Empowering them to take the money out of the mouths of children and give it to corporate America. That's going to be the empowerment. Oh, Rick, you're too harsh. Look at North Carolina right now.
Look at North Carolina. The legislature there rammed through a piece of legislation that's going to increase taxes on the poor in the state. They're going to do what Pennsylvania has, a flat tax. Instead of having the several tiers, the three tiers that they had, I think it was like 6, 7, and 7.75 for the top tier, flat tax cross. They're going to actually drop it down to 5.8. So people at the very bottom, the poor people, you're going to pay almost the exact same amount, but you're going to get nailed when it comes to fees and everything else. In fact, if you make $1 million a year there in North Carolina, this plan is going to give you an extra $10,000, a nice little tax cut, nice little going away present. And over the next couple of years, the rate's going to continue to go down. Why? What are they doing? Over the next 2 years, you're talking about a $500 million deficit. Over the next 5 years, you're talking about a $2 billion deficit. You know what's coming next? Oh, yeah. This is North Carolina we're talking about. This isn't New York. This isn't Pennsylvania. This is a state that already has a small state budget, a shrinking state budget. So what's that going to mean? Well, it's going to mean more cuts to education. What's it going to mean? It's going to mean more cuts to infrastructure. More cut and punish. And at the end of it, who ends up paying more of the taxes? Well, if you're in the 12,000 and under range, you're going to pay almost 2% higher in taxes. If you're in the 25%, you're going to pay about 2% higher. It's not until you hit the 113,000 and above strata that you're going to see a reduction. And that's the point. And if you're in the millionaire club, that's when you see the real savings. And that really is the goal here, isn't it? To make sure that the very well-to-do are more well-to-do. That the tax code benefits them. And why do you think the Koch brothers spend so much money? Why do you think they spent so much of their fortune pushing to get rid of the estate tax, pushing to get rid of income tax, pushing to get rid of corporate tax? Because you look at this thing in North Carolina, lowering the corporate tax rate again. In fact, it's going to go down from 6.9% down to 6 in 2014, down to 5 in 2015, and then 2017 down to as low as 3%. Where's that money going to come from? Well, you know it's going to come from the schools. You know the schools are going to get hit. Sales taxes on, and this is the, you know, this is the kicker. Sales taxes on manufactured and modular homes. And electric sales would increase. Who gets hit by those? Of course, low-income residents. Of course. So you've already got a system set up where in the state, the bottom 80% pay between 9 and 10% of their income in taxes, be it sales tax, income tax, whatever, to where the ones at the very top pay just 6.5%. This plan is going to put that up upside down on its head. But that's what we want, right? You know, I'm reminded of the tax break that they gave out. That you know when you pay your taxes, you go to work and you collect a paycheck, and at the end of the week you see your pay stub and there's on their state tax. I'll never forget the thing that they rammed through last year that said that the employer gets to keep the state tax that you think you're paying to the state for roads and bridges and education. That was one of my favorite moments, I got to be honest. That's one of those things that makes you think. What really are the priorities? And look, you know, Scott Conklin and I, we kind of made fun at the Republicans for this really just ignorant idea. Because I don't think anybody thinks they're serious about this. And as I read more of the statement, and they say, well, you know, we spent $1 trillion for those poor people. We want to know if we're spending it right. Well, you've been working as hard as you can to ruin those programs. And I remember right when the recession hit, I knew a couple of people who had lost their job, and they were working their way through the system. And they couldn't believe how difficult the system was to navigate, how cumbersome it was. And they're like, why is this so difficult? See, government doesn't work. It's so difficult. And I had to slow them down and say, stop. Think about why all of these things are in place. Why all of these roadblocks were put in place. Well, one of the reasons was to deny you access to them. If we can put a barrier between you and the program that you can't hurdle, you don't get it. And then we make you desperate enough that you're going to take some crummy, the first crummy thing that comes along, and that pulls us all back. See, there was a time, and I think about my grandparents' generation, and I know I go back to this a lot because I knew a lot of them who understood. You know, they were still hooray for me, and let's not get carried away. But they understood that, you know, we're all in this together, and that if I'm slitting your throat, somebody's going to slit mine. That this race to the bottom was no good for working people. But we've been sold. And it just popped into my head when I was down at Disney over Christmas with the kids and the conversations I had with the South Carolina people, which, you know, was really eye-opening about the education system there. Their belief was simply that the economy was struggling because there wasn't enough competition. There was too much regulation and too high of taxes. Yet, globally, we're one of the lower tax rate countries in the globe because of all the handouts and subsidies we give to these big companies. Competitively, you stop and think about, where's the competition? Well, it's how little you're willing to work for. It's no longer on quality or efficiency or productivity. It's on who's going to do it cheapest. And as I look at this, and we spent a lot of time on the road here, and you look at these neighborhoods that have been abandoned, I'm hoping some of these Republicans, if they're really serious about this, go into some of these blighted areas and really ask the questions why, and really ask the questions how can we help, instead of going in with their predetermined ideology, which is these are just lazy and stupid people. If you're poor, you must be lazy and shiftless. If you're unemployed, it's because you just want to lay around and collect a check all day. Or if you're a union member, you just want an easy job. I love that one. You just want an easy job. And I go, what exactly does that mean? But I don't think this is serious from them. And I think we're going to reach out to the Mr. Reed's office to see if he's willing to come and talk to us about the program. Because this has piqued my interest. Because I remember growing up in poverty. I remember living in a housing project. And I remember seeing the blight. And I remember seeing the despair and the hopelessness. And I remember the programs that did help. That did make people's lives better. At a time when government was seen as a partner. You know who it was who brought us, government's not the solution, it's the problem? Well, the guy whose ideology brought us to this point, brought us to a point where we have the largest billionaire class in history and one of the largest poverty classes as well. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? It's right there, folks, right in front of you. And it comes back down to tax codes like what they're doing in North Carolina and what we've done here in Pennsylvania. It just is exactly what it is. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can get the podcast there at the website. Also, Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. Going to take a quick break. Back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus joined fast food and retail workers and their supporters in Milwaukee on Monday to speak out against wage theft and to urge a pay raise for these workers. U.S. Representatives Keith Ellison, Gwen Moore, and Danny Davis appeared in Milwaukee in support of the Raise Up Milwaukee campaign. They're urging the rest of Congress to focus on raising pay and bringing good jobs to cities like Milwaukee. Community supporters of the workers, including clergy, joined Monday's action in Milwaukee. Employers are increasingly stealing wages by forcing workers to work off the clock, denying them overtime pay, or forcing them to use fee-laden pay cards to get paid. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus are traveling the country this summer, highlighting income inequality and the struggle to raise wages and benefit standards for low-wage workers. When striking Smithsonian federally contracted workers brought their protest to the home of Smithsonian Secretary Wayne Clough, he told them they need to talk to their employers, not the museum that contracts with those employers. But the Smithsonian and other federal entities that contract this work out have the power to set standards. Here's part of the exchange the Smithsonian Secretary had with the low-wage federally contracted workers at the door of his home.
We're trying to give you this letter and stuff. We would like to get a see if we can get a meeting with you.
Well, you guys really need to talk to your employees, and that's McDonald's and restaurant directors instead of me. Because we contract that with them. Because this is an outsourced part of what we do.
Okay.
Well, okay. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
All right.
U.S. Steel plans to force a vote on workers at a plant in Ontario. Nearly 1,000 workers at the plant have been locked out by the company since April. Jesse Russell reports.
U.S. Steel has asked the government to intervene and make what it calls a final contract vote happen. The move comes only a week after the government chose to not extend employment insurance to the locked out workers. The United Steelworkers had argued that part of the reason for the lockout was due to Ottawa's failure to enforce promises made to workers by U.S. Steel when it bought out Stelco 6 years ago. The local has claimed that U.S. Steel introduced a contract it knew the union would be unable to accept so it could lock out the workers and idle the Canadian plant, thereby increasing production at plants elsewhere. The most recent contract offer from U.S. Steel had been rejected by the union's bargaining team on July 12th.
U.S. Airways workers are protesting that they are mired in poverty wages while executive pay at the airline soars. U.S. Airways is merging with American Airlines. Executives want even more money when the merger happens. SEIU 32BJ President Hector Figueroa says it's an unfair system that rewards a few at the top at the expense of the worker bees. The workers recently took their complaints to a U.S. Airways shareholders meeting in New York City. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Stop by the way to hold me to account. We put it by the way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us? Are you listening? You know how we account.
Yeah, I still can't get it out of my head. This empowering opportunities, gateways out of poverty listening tour. Maybe I'm just too cynical. Maybe the Republicans really do, deep down in their heart, care about poor people. Maybe they really do. Maybe they care that, you know, children get fed. But, you know, you look at the farm bill. You're going to strip out the food stamp portion of it and then hand off massive amounts to agribusiness. You know, I look at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group study that came out, said that, you know, 74% of all of the subsidies from the farm bill go to 4% of the agribusinesses. 4%. So we got plenty of corporate welfare, but, you know, food stamp for kids? Hell no, we can draw the line. Amazing stuff. Anyway, I've got our good friend on the line, Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So have you seen this? Representative Dave Reed, the policy committee chairman, is going to have a listening tour on poverty. They're going to I don't know what they haven't said where they're going yet, but they're going to go. They're going to go look for those pores.
Yeah, yeah, and we should all be grateful, shouldn't we? I mean, this is nothing more than a gambit. I really don't know what the crux of it is, and I'm not having any of this, Rick. I'm not buying it at all. And given what you just mentioned there, with agribusiness and cutting out food stamps for poor kids, I mean, this is the chairman of the policy committee for the Republicans in the House. And I'm not expecting a whole heck of a lot out there. I expect a lot of cynicism from our part, no doubt about it. But I don't really foresee anything substantive coming out of this listening tour at all.
I see more blame. I got to be honest. I see it as the same thing they did with people who are unemployed and can't find jobs and lost jobs through no fault of their own. They pointed the fingers at them, said, you're lazy, you're shiftless, you drink too much. All of that stuff is going to be more finger-pointing, more blame, more degrading, more of that.
That's right, and more stereotyping as well. Unfortunately, this has just been a successful gambit that the Republican Party has exploited for many years. They like to make people afraid of the weak, of the poor, of the downtrodden, of the less fortunate, and really point fingers. I mean, this was one of the philosophies that got Ronald Reagan so much attention, so much publicity, and lamentably, so much success as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's the urbans. It's the urbans. And for me, since you brought up the sainted Ronald Reagan, he did have a quote that I agree with. You know, the best anti-poverty program? Jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yet the Republican Party has done absolutely zilch, nothing in terms of jobs. All we have to do, Rick, is point to their failed attempt at passing a comprehensive transportation bill. All you have to do is say that.
How hard is this to do? I mean, we all agree. We don't want to, at least I think, maybe since you know these people a lot better than I do, maybe I'm wrong. But I assume that we all want to drive on roads that aren't going to collapse under our wheels, that we want to get from one place to another in a reasonable amount of time without too much damage to our cars. Is that too much to ask for bridges that aren't going to fall down and roads that aren't going to open up?
Not at all. It's not too much to ask. Unfortunately, it makes way too much sense. And we also have an ineffective state legislature controlled by Republicans, led by Mike Terzai, the majority leader from Allegheny County, who basically tied booze to bridges and roads, Rick. That's exactly what he did. He held the transportation bill hostage, waiting for a privatization bill to come out of the Senate. So he and Dominic Pileggi, the majority leader of the state Senate, had this staring contest. They were playing chicken with each other, but the real losers were the people of Pennsylvania who are not going to get their roads and bridges fixed, and we're not going to create any jobs as a result of it. Now, there's talk that maybe there's going to be a special session in the fall, but, Rick, I'm not buying it.
In the fall? Well, the fall?
We have blown the opportunity because now we're going to miss construction, the rest of construction season here in 2013, and I am under absolutely no illusions that anything's going to get done in 2014 in the middle of elections. That's just not going to happen. So in essence, we're going to lose out on three construction seasons, and maybe we'll get lucky and they'll start talking about this again in 2015.
Well, but at least they passed the budget on time, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can argue that as well. I mean, the fiscal notes were finally passed yesterday, Rick, and that's the end of the – I mean, that should be the cap of the budget bill. So, you know, you could successfully argue that they didn't even get that right. I mean, this is ridiculous. You have a Republican-controlled House, a Republican-controlled Senate, and you have a governor who's hanging by a thread at 24% approval ratings. Not a whole lot to look forward to in Pennsylvania.
That high, huh?
Yeah.
That's impressive. You know, because we were on the road for a month. We were moving across country doing our labor history tour when the transportation bill evidently went down. And what I found interesting from the road, and since you were here, maybe you can fill us in a little bit on it. The Republicans, who are the vast majority, I mean, they've got steamroller power. They blame the Democrats for not getting a transportation bill. Am I getting that?
Yeah, which is one of the silliest things you ever want to come up with. There were Democrats who were poised to vote for the transportation bill. Democrats understand that we have to do something today, not tomorrow, not a week from next Thursday, but today. Needed to be done. Well, they couldn't put that together. And then what they really wanted to do was tie transportation to privatization. And again, like I said earlier, Terzai wanted to hold the transportation bill hostage because he promised all of his friends that had special interests that they were going to get some sort of privatization done. They blew it with the lottery. They blew it with the state store system. So they couldn't cobble enough votes together. And on top of that, you have a bunch of Tea Party whack jobs out there who were just exploiting the fact that, yes, it's going to cost a little bit more at the gas pump to raise the necessary revenues to fix our roads and bridges and put people back to work. And they didn't want anything to do with that either. And yet they blame the Democrats. How can you blame the Democrats when they are the minority party? They were willing to stick their necks out. They were willing to put together a coalition of Democrats who wanted to see transportation done. They understood the magnitude of this problem. They understood the fact that we're going to have, unfortunately, a tragedy before the next time they deliberate upon this. And then that's going to force all kinds of people into action. There are going to be a million moving parts and not going to get it done correctly then either. But what we've done is we've opened up the floodgates to something really bad happening right now because of their inability to lead. When you are the majority party, you have a responsibility to lead. And they blew it. They failed. Mike Terzai was at the helm of that. Governor Corbett has a lot to do with it also. But, you know, when you put these guys and gals that don't know what they're doing in power and in office, these are the terrible results, the real tangible the results that taxpayers get.
Well, let me put you on the spot here then, because
sure.
You've taken the position that they don't know. Or I'm assuming you're taking the position that they don't know what they're doing. I would argue, they know exactly what they're doing. They're systematically destroying our functioning what's left of our functional government, and I think they're doing it on purpose.
Well, it's no secret that they wish to starve government as much as possible. There's no doubt about it. I just think that they're horrible in terms of putting together coalitions to make things function. That's what I meant by they don't know what they're doing. I think that Mike Terzai is one of the most ineffective, just completely inefficient leaders that's ever held that position. And if it weren't for the fact that he's propped up by his Tea Party supporters on the right, I don't think he'd have a leadership position right now. And I know that there's going to be a lot of questioning and finger-pointing in the next several months, especially if, heaven forbid, something happens out on a bridge.
But, I mean, at some point, the average everyday voter, and, you know, because your average low-information voter's got to look at this and go, what? They've got steamroller power. They didn't pass the budget on time. They've got steamroller power. They didn't pass a transportation bill. They couldn't even push through their ideology of privatization. You know, they're dysfunctional top to bottom. Get them out. Try something else.
That's exactly right, Rick. That's the message that has to permeate throughout the entire electorate. And I'm hoping that that's going to be the case next year. I mean, throw them all out because they're ineffective. They're really not bringing anything back to the people of Pennsylvania. They can't even agree amongst themselves. I mean, for a Republican-controlled House not to be able to have a constructive dialogue with a Republican-controlled Senate, it's just unbelievable. And the fact that you have a Republican governor in the middle who can't navigate, who can't even get along with members of his own party and the leadership of his own party, I mean, they basically told him to pound sand, right? That's what this was. I mean, he was 0-for-3 in terms of legislative accomplishments, and that can't be lost on the electorate next year. So they have to pin the blame not just on the governor, but a very ineffective House and an ineffective Senate that couldn't cobble together enough negotiating power to put together a solid transportation bill. Rick, we haven't had a transportation bill in 16 years.
Wow.
That's how long this has gone. And now we're going to put ourselves at risk of waiting another 16 years? This is deplorable. I mean, this is one of the most disappointing things that I've seen in 20-plus years and watching the happenings at the Capitol.
And I hope you're wrong. I hope it doesn't take a tragedy.
Me too.
I hope no one loses life or limb or any. There are, I'm hoping for no tragedies. But at some point, you get to the point where, you know, If you're not investing and you're allowing your infrastructure to crumble, there's got to be negative consequences. If not a, a catastrophe, we're going to then be the state where everyone leaves. And, oh, by the way, as Scott Conklin said earlier, we lost more jobs than any state in the country last month.
That's exactly right, Reagan. We're going to continue on that slippery slope unless we have some proactive leadership. I mean, leadership that actually cares and wants to accomplish something, not just starve government and not just point fingers. And by the way, the Democrats were brought in on that discussion at the last minute. I mean, I spent all my time up at the Capitol, and they had serious discussions with the Democratic leadership 3 days before they actually got out of town. So for them to point fingers at Democrats is absolutely reprehensible. It's irresponsible, and it's also a sham. And everybody sees through it, by the way.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning on a completely different topic. You know, I've been asking everybody about what happened on Saturday with the decision down in Florida. I was curious your thoughts on if you're willing to share your thoughts with us on the verdict down in Florida.
Yes, I understand that these matters are very volatile and very sensitive in terms of race. The jury did speak begrudgingly. I must agree with what the president said and basically just echo that same statement that the jury has spoken. Yes, there are a lot of discrepancies and a lot of inequalities in our judicial system, but it's still the best judicial system in the country. And I understand that you're going to have folks like the Reverend Al Sharpton going out and doing 100 rallies and bringing more attention to the cause, but it's a tragic incident, one that we have to reflect on. And perhaps there are those inequalities. I happen to think that there are lots of inequalities in the legal system, but we have to live with those decisions as well. They're not popular, but I mean, the system functioned. I'm not saying that it's the most popular decision out there, obviously, but at the end of the day, you have to respect the jury system that came up with that decision.
Well, I've now figured out two ways I can legally kill somebody now. I can employ you. You can be an employee of mine, and you can get killed on the job, and probably nothing will happen to me. Or I can pick a fight with you, and you could beat me up, and I can shoot you because I fear for my life. Instead of when I was a kid, you just got your butt kicked for sticking your nose where it didn't belong. Now I can shoot you for it.
That's right. And you used fists when we were kids, Rick. You didn't use all kinds of weapons like you do today. I mean, yeah. It's absolutely it's a tragic, tragic event.
Sad, sad stuff. Abe, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Likewise.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for LIUNA, the Laborers International Union. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Representative Jim Hines says it's appalling. He was talking about the money that special interests stuff in the pockets of our lawmakers. It's disgusting, and it opens the possibility of conflicts of interest and corruption, he added. So, naturally, he promptly joined the discussion. System that has turned our capital into a wide-open bazaar for buying and selling legislative favors. It's unfortunately the world we live in, the Connecticut Democrat shrugged. Even though Himes is only in his third term, he's become an aggressive trader in this bazaar, heading up fundraising for his fellow Democrats in the U.S. House. Why him? One, as a member of the committee that oversees Wall Street, he can attract campaign cash like honey attracts flies, especially when big banks are lobbying furiously to get exemptions from legislation that restricts some of their destructive profiteering. Two, Himes has proven to be a trusted ally of the Wheeler Dealer bankers, supporting their dereg bills. And three, he's one of them, having been made a millionaire as a Goldman Sachs banker. Republicans are totally in Wall Street's pocket, but Democrats are sinking into it, too. With the admirable exception of Representative Maxine Waters and a handful of other Dems who stood with consumers, most Democrats on the committee joined every Republican member in May to do the bank lobby's bidding. 6 days later, Himes' fundraising operation arranged for the seven freshman Democrats on the committee, each of whom had stood with the bankers, to trek up to the heights of Wall Street for a personal bonding session with the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. Thus are forged the ties that bind. This is Jim Hightower saying, hey, Democrats, don't just deplore this corrupt system. Stand with us to overthrow it. To learn how, go to www.publiccampaign.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence. Your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So on Sunday at a concert in Quebec, Stevie Wonder was on stage talking about, you know, look, you know, I'm, to be honest, the truth is that for those that are being lost in the battles for justice, whatever that fits in any part of the world, we can't bring them back. What we can do is let our voices be heard, and we can vote in our various countries throughout the world for change and for equality for everyone. He says, I know we can do it. I'm not everybody, he says. I'm just one person. I'm a human being. But for the gift that God has given me, for whatever I mean, I decide today that until Stand Your Ground law is abolished in Florida, I will never perform there again. He says, as a matter of fact, wherever I find that law exists, I will not perform in the state or in any part of the world. And, you know, you look at this and you go, this is maybe what it takes. Maybe it takes, you know, we're leaving those places. Because, you know, I find it really hard. The concept of the law, and, you know, I remember when all of this was being passed and the ALEC legislation was going, and here in Pennsylvania, of course, they, you know, they ran through the Castle Doctrine, which on some level I agree with. Look, if someone's breaking into your house, if someone is truly there to do you deadly harm, you absolutely have the right to defend yourself. But when you're talking about a situation where you have chosen to put yourself in harm's way, where you're told repeatedly, don't do it. Don't go out there. The guy in Texas, same thing. Don't go out there. Guy in Florida, don't go out there. And then you get yourself in a twist by just getting a beating. Look, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you got a beating. And you got smacked around. Now that's turned into, we're going to shoot you. And I worry about the ramifications beyond this case.
because the message that that's sending is that, you know what, I can confront anyone without fear of repercussion. And I found it interesting, you know, the juror B37 was interviewed by Anderson Cooper. And there were some interesting things that came out of the interview, such as, you know, she believed that, you know, Martin was the kid was responsible for his own death because he defended himself. I mean, I put myself in that situation, and I know it's easy to put yourself in Zimmerman's position, but put yourself in the kid's position. You got this guy who you're walking down the streets eating Skittle and drinking iced tea. And this guy gets in your face. What are you going to tell him? We were talking about this at lunch today. You know, and you know, I think of all the 100 things that I would have said today, not when I was 17, because I was not the fine, upstanding young man I am today. You know, when I was 17, as most of us were, I was kind of mouthy. I'd have told you what was what, because I knew everything at 17. It's amazing how I get older and I realize I know less than I did yesterday. But I find it interesting that the jurors said, well, you know, it's his own fault. You know, they could have just both walked away. I don't think so. I don't think the kid could have walked away. Cooper asked her if she felt sorry for the kid. She said, no, I feel sorry for them both. I feel sorry for George Zimmerman because he got himself in this situation. And you go, I don't know. And I look at this, and just a lot of this just kind of makes me go, it's bad law. You know, we've heard two people tonight that I've asked who, they didn't know the question was coming. I talked to State Representative Scott Conklin. He didn't know it was coming. Our friend Abe, they didn't know it was coming. And they both pointed to the law. And my hope is that Al Sharpton and the rest of them, when they have their rallies and they have their marches, they point to the law. It's bad law. It's bad precedent. It's bad policy. Nobody's saying you can't defend yourself. But there's got to be a point. And this is what I think is a scary moment because of the message that's being sent. And I've harped on this because I think it's that important. Because we've become a less civil society. And I think a lot of it has to do with the internet. I think a lot of things get said online and a lot of things get said in text and an email that you would never have said to someone's face. I think we've gotten used to saying things to each other in ways without looking each other in the eye that at some point it gets to the point where we're going to be willing to say that to someone's face. And I don't know that we know how to handle that. And I've said before, I think things were better when kids met out on the playground and smacked each other around a little bit. Because you learned respect. At least maybe this is just my twisted view of this. And you learned not to do dumb stuff like this. And that if you did say something stupid, and if you did do something stupid, someone puts you in your place. We don't do that much anymore, do we? And this, I don't know how much more I'm going to talk about this, because, you know, it's one of those moments where you go, all right, we've covered it. There's other things we should be talking about. There's a transportation bill that didn't get passed. There's a budget that didn't get passed on time. That's horrible. We've defunded education. We've defunded our infrastructure. We don't have a Medicaid expansion plan. We don't have a plan in this state to get people health insurance that they need. But this is a situation where a young man lost his life because of bad law, of bad policy. question is, are we going to push back? I think Stevie Wonder's right. You know, this is where our voices, our votes, this is where all of that matters. And I go back to, you know, who we put into these positions, these ideologues, the NRA-approved types. Because remember, they're the NRA are the people who brought you this, along with Alec and the rest of them. So it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of days, because the media has just been on a riot fetish. Every time I turn around, there's riots somewhere, and then you pan over there, and there's nothing going on. There's a bunch of people standing around. I'm sure fake news at Fox has, you know, got the Black Panther Party marching everywhere, opening doors for little old ladies. I woke up this morning, there are riots in L.A. You find out there are no riots going on. And I think part of it is just the message machine is praying for there to be some. Because I guess, you know, that's the stuff that people want to see. Anyway, got to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got to get older tonight. We got to do it today. No more madness to do. No more history. We got to get older tonight.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Well, at least he's honest. You got to give him credit for being honest. That was, at the time, one of the main reasons that they passed this voter suppression law. They rammed this through. The other part of it is, as this Bernard Siskin guy testified today, a statistical expert, day two of the suppression trial here in Pennsylvania, he testified that some 511,000 current legally registered voters, they don't have these state IDs. And who are these people? Well, according to Mr. Siskin, they're mostly Democrats, minorities, is what it is, which is why we've asked Marion Schneider. She is with the staff attorney with the Advancement Project, advancementproject.org, the website. Marion, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, at the very beginning there, you hear Mike Turzai saying, you know, voter ID, done. I'm going to throw the election for Romney. And for me, I look at that as that was the main reason. None of this... You know, this nonsensical, we're going to protect the ballot, that just seems ludicrous to me.
Well, the incidence of voter fraud is really very rare, the kind of voter fraud that a voter ID would prevent. So the only kind of voter fraud this would prevent is if somebody went to the polling place and tried to impersonate somebody else. And that kind of voter fraud is extraordinarily rare. And
in fact,
not only that,
in fact, Marion, so rare, in fact, so rare that in the last trial, in the stipulation of fact, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania said that there has never been a case that they've prosecuted. There's never been a case that they know of, and they're not currently prosecuting any. So to me, you go, well, if you're admitting right from the beginning of the last trial that this would stop nothing because it's never been prosecuted before, seems to me to be kind of a waste of time.
Well, I don't disagree with that. That stipulation is still part of the record in this case, and we're certainly going to hold them to the stipulation that they made the last time around.
So 511,000 currently registered voters, people who are legally registered right now, who still don't – is that a conservative number? Because I keep seeing numbers in the 700,000. Is that the current number? What is that?
Okay, so it is a conservative number. We retained an expert, Dr. Bernard Siskin, to do a comparison of the PennDOT database of all Pennsylvanians that have some kind of a either driver's license or non-driver photo ID or the new Department of State ID, and he compared that database with the SURE database, which is all the registered voters in Pennsylvania. And he had a 12-step matching process in which he tried to match voters in the PennDOT database. So he was so conservative, and that was the testimony in the courtroom today, was how he did the match. And that number is likely understated, but it's a very it's a very conservative number, but it's a very defensible number.
Yeah, to me, when I saw that, that's got to be the rock bottom number, because I've seen some 700, I've seen even up to over a million people who don't have them. And for me, you know, it's been 16 months since they rammed this through, so you would think in 16 months we'd have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people registered, right?
Well, they've only issued 17,000. Free IDs in which either the non-driver, PennDOT non-driver ID or the Department of State voter ID, since the law has been enacted. So they haven't done a good job of getting the word out, and they haven't done a good job of reaching out to these people who don't have IDs. And the numbers that you heard were from last summer when the Department of State did their own matching. And yeah, 750,000 didn't match, but then there was another 500,000 whose IDs were expired. So that's where you heard the 1.2 million.
But you know, I remember from the last trial that the Commonwealth kept throwing out a number. There are only 89,000 people who don't have them, according, if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong. But the Commonwealth, Secretary of State there, she said only 89,000 people didn't have it. Where did that number come from? That's just something they reached around behind and popped out?
Well, it's not too far away. In the last trial, Rebecca Euler testified that was just kind of a back-of-the-envelope calculation. They needed an estimate for the legislature and the fiscal statement, and that's the number she came up with. But we'll have evidence that she thinks the real number is more like 3-4%, which is very consistent with what Dr. Siskin testified to today.
So originally the 89,000 number is basically just a made-up number, and she admitted to that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, because you know, we just pulled it out of thin air. It sounded like a nice round number, 89. Well, no, 90 would have sounded better, but that, I guess, is a little high. One of the things that caught my attention, though, as I'm looking at this, and, you know, for me, I look at, you know, why is it that this now? Why in the middle of a recession? Why is it when you have an economic downturn? Why are we spending so much time, energy, and resource on this? And I go, you know, well, who's it targeted towards? And as this expert testified today, disproportionately affects, well, Democrats. To me, this looks like a consolidation of power. It looks like just purely trying to disenfranchise many of the minorities who, according to his testimony, this disproportionately affects, and, you know, college students, people like my grandmother, the elderly, and, of course, you know, people who are the poor and the disenfranchised already being kicked even further down. That's what it seems like to me.
Well, I think that Dr. Siskin's report shows that there is a disparate impact on those groups that you mentioned, and that it's statistically significant that the other African-Americans, Hispanics, non-whites are more likely than whites not to have a voter ID. And also Democrats are more likely not to have a voter ID than Republicans. And so are independents, interestingly enough. I thought that was a very interesting statistic. So the Democrats and the independents are more likely not to have ID than the Republicans. But that's an interesting part of the report. But I think what's really important about this report is that there are hundreds of thousands of people who don't have a PennDOT ID, and it's likely that they don't have another form of one of the limited other forms of acceptable ID, and those people would be disenfranchised, and a subset of those people actually voted in November of 2012, and they don't have ID. So people will be disenfranchised with this law, and it makes it harder for people to vote, and that's what's not only is it not fair, but in our view, it's unconstitutional.
Yeah, I'm with you. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Marian Schneider. She's a staff attorney with the Advancement Project. You know, we've just completed a cross-country labor history tour, and we stopped at the George W. Bush Presidential Library, the greatest president in the history of the country, he will tell you, and so will his library, with the Wall of Freedom. But anyway, I came across a picture there. I'm sure you've seen it. It's the woman with the burqa in Iraq with the ink on her finger. And I'm going, well, if ink on her finger was enough, because we liberated those people and we gave them the right to vote and all of that and all those wonderful things that they tell us, if that was good enough, why do we have to go through all of this arduous process for people who already legally registered the vote in this country? Why do we have to go through this?
Well, I think that's a question really for the Pennsylvania legislature and for the governor and for the secretary. I mean, we shouldn't have to go through this. We should be doing everything in our power to engage our citizens and increase participation in elections. And that, to do that, we have to make it easier for people to participate and easier for them to vote. Act 18 just makes it harder for everyone to vote, for people to vote. And not everyone has ID, and that's what's wrong with the law.
So is it that people don't have IDs, and if we just got everybody an ID, everything would be wonderful? Or is this idea, this concept of everyone having to have an ID, is this a flawed concept? Because to me, you know, I know people who, they have no need for it. They're never going to drive a car. There's no need. My grandmother, for instance, doesn't need it. She hasn't driven a car in 15 years. And her driver's license, sadly, is about 12 years outdated. So for her to go to a place on a certain day, a certain hour, who knows when they're open or if they're open or if there's one even in the area where she lives, because I found out that there are 9 counties in the Commonwealth that don't even have a center where she can go to get a voter ID.
That's right, and there's 22 other counties in which the centers only open 1 or 2 days a week. So that's 31 counties that it's either they have none or they're only open 1 or 2 days. And that's almost half the state. As far as ID, I mean, people will debate whether you need ID to manage the, daily living. But as far as for voting, the current law, the ID requirements for first-time voters has worked fine. We already know there's been no voter fraud. And that list of IDs is much broader. And everybody has something. One of the IDs that's acceptable is your voter registration card. You know, that would be okay to continue the existing law. But what this law does is eliminate certain kinds of IDs, makes it much harder. It's a much shorter list of what's acceptable. Eliminates IDs that people have. For example, a veteran's card doesn't work under the voter ID law. Any ID without an expiration date doesn't work except for PennDOT IDs, and they can be expired for a year. So what this law does is just make it more difficult. And it doesn't, as we've been saying all along, it's a solution in search of a problem.
And what it does, and you know, this whole expiration date thing is, it's like the glowing red bulb that says, you know, this is just another obstacle, because this is another way, another point of contact for them to suppress the vote and hold people away from their right to exercise, their right to vote or their right to the franchise. And because, you know, in 10 years, am I going to change who I am? No. It seems dumb to me, but it's what they've sold us.
Well, what we're trying to do with this litigation is invalidate Act 18, and we hope that we'll be successful. And
I hope so, too.
At the same, okay.
No, I hope you're right. I hope they overturn this, and I absolutely hope that some sanity comes out of all of this. Because, you know, I was looking at in the Commonwealth, there are 71 places in the 67 counties where you can go to get one of these IDs. 71 places. If I were to roll this out, if really your purpose was to have an ID in everyone's hand and you really wanted to get voters to have these IDs, why not set up places at those 9,300 polling places across the Commonwealth and say, hey, when you come to vote, we'll get you an ID. That seems like someone who would want to get you the IDs instead of, well, there's 71 of them, 9 counties don't have any, and as you said, 22 have limited hours, so good luck getting off work or finding a bus that gets there. To me, it just seems ill-conceived and, well, I guess completely properly conceived if the goal is to hold the vote down, as our governor said in the race in 2010, if you could just hold that vote in Philadelphia down.
Right. Well, I think that's correct. And that's what you pointed out is what we are arguing is the legal flaw with Act 18, with the voter ID law, because there's nothing in the statute that mandates the Commonwealth to get ID to those who lack it. That's why it's unconstitutional. There's nothing in the law that says they have to get ID to people who lack it. So by setting it up the way you've described, they're almost guaranteeing that people aren't going to be able to get it. The fact that they haven't mandated that the Commonwealth get ID to those who lack it is the major flaw in the statute.
I got two last questions for you. One, are we against the ID concept as a whole? Are we against, because I hear people tell me, well, you're against the voter ID. You want anyone to vote. I do. I want everyone to vote. But should we know who they are, I guess, is the other question.
No, it's just as I said before. We're not against the concept of voter ID. We've actually had voter ID law in Pennsylvania for first-time voters since 2002. People have something on that list because your voter registration card is one of the IDs on the list, among a much broader list of photo ID and a list of non-photo ID. So it's not that we're against the concept of ID. What we're against is a concept of ID that disenfranchises people. That, if there was a broader list, if it was the same as existing law, and if the Commonwealth was required to get the appropriate ID into the hands of those who lack it, then it would be okay. So you have to, it's not that we're against ID, it's we're against a law that disenfranchises validly registered voters.
And to me, that's the point in all of this. So last question I've got for you, you know, I hear this all the time. I need an ID to rent a car. I need an ID to rent a hotel room. I need a driver's license to do all of these things. What's the response back to that? I mean, I have my canned response, but I'm curious what yours is.
Well, first of all, you know, if you have a driver's license, you get the driver's license so you can operate a motor vehicle. So that's a little bit different. That's a privilege, and there are requirements for that privilege. But to say that you need an ID to do certain other things, if you don't have a photo ID, you can still do it. They have work, you know, they have a safety net. They have the ability for you to do things, even if you don't have a photo ID. For example, you can still fly without a photo ID. There is a process for that. Some IDs that don't work for voting work for those other things. So it's not that, none of those things, I mean, none of those things rise to the level of voting. Voting is a fundamental right. It's the most fundamental right. And we shouldn't be taking away because people don't have one of these limited forms of acceptable ID.
Yeah, I'm with you. I appreciate the time, Marianne. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Marianne Schneider, staff attorney with the Advancement Project, the website advancementproject.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, what causes the aurora borealis, or northern lights?
Some Inuit believed the spirits of their ancestors could be seen dancing in the flickering lights. In Norse mythology, the aurora was a fire bridge to the sky built by the gods.
But science tells us the aurora happens because of the sun. Storms on the sun send gusts of charged solar particles hurling across space. If Earth is in the path of the particle stream, our planet's magnetic field and atmosphere react. When the charged particles from the sun strike atoms and molecules in Earth's atmosphere, they cause them to become excited.
Atoms consist of a central nucleus and a surrounding cloud of electrons. When charged particles from the sun strike atoms in Earth's atmosphere, electrons move to higher energy orbits further away from the nucleus. Then, when an electron moves back to a lower energy orbit, the atoms release light.
And that's what causes an aurora. What happens is similar to what happens in neon signs. Electricity is used to excite the atoms and gases within the glass tubes of these signs. That's why these signs give off their brilliant colors. Oxygen causes the color green. Nitrogen causes blue or red colors. The aurora works on the same principle, but at a far more vast scale.
For more, come to EarthSky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
Oh, I gotta tell you, it's awful hot here today. So, warm enough. The climate has changed enough for me, and we better start adapting quick. Maybe air condition the outside as well. Just a thought. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. I look at this voter suppression thing, and what stuck with me in talking with our guest was, in 16 months, just 17,000 of these voter IDs have been put into the hands of the, well, 750,000 voters that are, or the 511,000 that the very conservative estimate points out. That means once this goes into effect, you're talking about 494,000 people off the voter rolls. Boy, would that be mission accomplished? Would that not be the dream of the GOP? Wouldn't that be what Corbett wanted, to suppress the vote? Absolutely. Man, I mean, that's a winner. I mean, right there. And as she said, look, nobody's against you saying who you are and verifying that you are who you say you are. Right now, the system is set up where you have to have an address, which I got to be honest, part of me has a problem with, because what if you're homeless? What about the folks who are homeless who are going to lose out? That's a whole nother argument. But we're talking 511,000 people that this guy testified today. 511,000 people. If this stands, off the voter rolls. And in 16 months, understand, in 16 months, they got 17,000 people. We're what? About 16 months from the next election? Less than that? Does anybody reasonably believe that we're going to get the other 494,000 people, miraculously, these IDs? These are people who are legally registered to vote.
And what I find interesting, it's the people who keep telling me they believe in the rule of law, they believe in contracts, they believe, but yet every time there's a moment where they can go against that, they do. These are people who jump through the hoops. And now we're going to make them jump through more hoops. And then we're going to say, well, your ID is only good for 10 years. And if it goes out of date, you can't vote. And now you've got another set of hoops to deal with. Does that make sense to you? I mean, really, I get past the whole, well, I need a driver's license to rent a hotel room. I don't have a constitutional right to rent a hotel room. Your ability to rent a hotel room or rent a car or any of that stuff, that's not the linchpin of our democracy. I'm sorry, it's just not. Your right to that ballot box is. Your right to cast that ballot is. And what stops me, what gives me pause, is how easily we give away incrementally our security, we give away our privacy, and how easily it happens. And how easily they shift us to different thought processes. You know, I walked into the supermarket the other day, and first time since I've ever seen it, there were more people in the do-it-yourself line than there were in the cashier lines. Because I'll be honest with you, I never use the do-it-yourselfer. And when I do, I always screw it up. And mostly on purpose, to be honest with you, so that a worker has to come over and have a job. And today, you know, I took my wife to lunch. And we sit down, and what was voluntary about a month ago to use this little screen on the table, which was voluntary a month ago, is now mandatory. You can't order an appetizer at the restaurant we went to without fiddling with the little screen. And I said, I'm not doing it. So the waitress got my son to do it. And I'm going, wait a second, that wasn't the intent. And what stopped me in my tracks was that she didn't see it as them doing away with her job. She's redundant. And I couldn't explain that, look, if I'm ordering the way that you order for me, why do I need you? Why do they need you? If I'm going to sit at the screen and with my cell phone, whatever, if I'm going to be the one who puts it in and says, this is what I'm getting, why do I need a waitress? Why do I need anyone that I'm going to have to tip 20% or 25%, or I'm generally in the 28 to 30% range? Why do I need to do that if I'm the one doing the work? And there was no answer. It's more efficient. You know what's more efficient? Doing away with you. And that's the, you know, I put it up on my Facebook page. And you can go to our Facebook page, too, just, you know, Rick Smith or The Rick Smith Show. And someone actually said, well, it'll mean that the servers will get paid more. I'm going, really? You believe that? If you've got a situation now where the servers aren't making but minimum wage, what makes anyone think that the servers are going to make more? I see it as minimum wage jobs being diminished. There'll only be less minimum wage jobs. Interesting thought processes. Critical thinking, probably something we haven't done enough of. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you can go to get the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, like us over at Facebook. In fact, you can comment on our Facebook page. I have my personal profile, Rick Smith, or the show page, TheRickSmithShow.com. All there at the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break, back with hour three of the big program. We're going to talk about the NLRB. Uh-oh. It might actually work. Quick break.
Oh, 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the wealth.
your smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus joined fast food and retail workers and their supporters in Milwaukee on Monday to speak out against wage theft and to urge a pay raise for these workers. U.S. Representatives Keith Ellison, Gwen Moore, and Danny Davis appeared in Milwaukee in support of the Raise Up Milwaukee campaign. They're urging the rest of Congress to focus on raising pay and bringing good jobs to cities like Milwaukee. Community supporters of the workers, including clergy, joined Monday's action in Milwaukee. Employers are increasingly stealing wages by forcing workers to work off the clock, denying them overtime pay, or forcing them to use fee-laden pay cards to get paid. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus are traveling the country this summer, highlighting income inequality and the struggle to raise wages and benefit standards for low-wage workers. When striking Smithsonian federally contracted workers brought their protest to the home of Smithsonian Secretary Wayne Clough, he told them they need to talk to their employers, not the museum that contracts with those employers. But the Smithsonian and other federal entities that contract this work out have the power to set standards. Here's part of the exchange the Smithsonian Secretary had with the low-wage federally contracted workers at the door of his home.
We're trying to if you get mad at his staff, we would like to get a see if we can get a meeting with you.
Well, we just, you guys really need to talk to your employees, and that's McDonald's and restaurant service instead of me. Because we contract that with the stuff. Because this is an outsourced part of what we do.
Okay.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
U.S. Steel plans to force a vote on workers at a plant in Ontario. Nearly 1,000 workers at the plant have been locked out by the company since April. Jesse Russell reports.
U.S. Steel has asked the government to intervene and make what it calls a final contract vote happen. The move comes only a week after the government chose to not extend employment insurance to locked out workers. The United Steelworkers had argued that part of the reason for the lockout was due to Ottawa's failure to enforce promises made to workers by U.S. Steel when it bought out Stelco 6 years ago. The local has claimed that U.S. Steel introduced a contract it knew the union would be unable to accept, so it could lock out the workers and idle the Canadian plant, thereby increasing production at plants elsewhere. The most recent contract offer from U.S. Steel had been rejected by the union's bargaining team on July 12th.
U.S. Airways workers are protesting that they are mired in poverty wages while executive pay at the airline soars. U.S. Airways is merging with American Airlines. Executives want even more money when the merger happens. SEIU 32BJ President Hector Figueroa says it's an unfair system that rewards a few at the top at the expense of the worker bees. The workers recently took their complaints to a U.S. Airways shareholders meeting in New York City. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, you look at this and what we thought was going to happen was the big nuclear option where they were going to blow up the filibuster. Well,
an agreement was made. And in fact, Richard Cordray was confirmed, got a vote, not confirmed yet. He's not the guy yet. This took a couple hours, but got a vote. And I think it was like 60, he got 66 votes. So some Republicans did come over. He's going to be the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, you know, you look at this and you go, but damn time, don't you think? Also, the president has nominated Nancy Schiffer, who's a retired associate general counsel of the AFL-CIO, and Kent Wazura. He is currently the chief counsel for the NLRB's chairman. So maybe, possibly, you will have a functional board to deal with. Anyway, here to talk to us about this development and maybe where this goes from here is John Logan. He's a professor at the of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, also a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be on.
So, no nuclear option. No boom.
No. So, I think the accepted wisdom is that the Senate didn't go nuclear, but it kind of did. At least that's what the Democrats are claiming. They're claiming that they got more or less what they wanted without having to adopt the nuclear option, which they didn't really want to do in the first place. They did have to drop the two recess appointments, Richard Griffin and, Sharon Block. Yeah. And because, you know, the Republicans had made such a stink, which was ridiculous because, you know, the only thing that those two had done wrong was to say yes when the White House asked them to serve.
Yep.
Then we got this crazy decision from the D.C. Circuit saying the recess appointments were unconstitutional. And not only that, according to the logic of that decision, hundreds of recess appointments over the past three decades would have been invalid. But the Republicans said that as a result of that decision, they should have resigned immediately and that they were breaking the law and stealing taxpayers' money and all sorts of other ridiculous things by continuing to serve on the board. So really, you know, there should have been, even if their objection was to how the president appointed Block and Griffin, they could have removed any doubt about their legitimacy simply by allowing a confirmation vote on them.
Yep.
So it was ridiculous not to proceed with those two. It's just a reflection of how extreme the Republican Party is on labor issues these days. But still, it appears that we now have a deal to have a functioning, to have an up or down vote on five nominees. Three Democrats, two of them new, as you said, Nancy Schiffer, who is a truly excellent lawyer, who was at the UAW before moving to the AFL and and serving as associate counsel of the AFL. She will be a terrific board member. Kent, I mean, highly qualified. We will have, one is assuming that the Republicans have agreed to allow an up or down vote on these five nominees and we will have a functioning board. But, you know, given everything that's happened over the past few months, both with the Republicans, the corporations who have been challenging the right of the board to enforce orders, and of course the craziness from the D.C. Circuit and the other courts striking down the board's right to make rules concerning notice posting. This is certainly a victory for. But a minor one, you know, given that, you know, the sort of insanity that still prevails on the other side.
Now, does this mean that the filibuster, that they've agreed not to use them in, so much in the future? I mean, because as I'm looking at the numbers, the number of filibusters that the Republicans have done over the last couple of years are just mind-blowing.
Right. And I think the only agreement is not to use them for concerning presidential nominations to agencies and to judicial nominations. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any agreement that, you know, as you say, I mean, it's being used in a very cynical and brazen way as a routine strategy, both to block any kind of legislative agenda. They're simply refusing to accept the fact that they lost the election and, you know, refusing to allow majority rule to prevail in the Senate, for everything. But also, as we saw with the NLRB up until this agreement today, to prevent, agencies that they don't like, from doing their work. And you know, that this is an important point, that their objections were never anything to do with the nominees themselves. There was never any question that these were highly qualified, excellent nominees, the five original nominees. The Republicans simply don't like the fact that the role of the National Labor Relations Board is to enforce federal law and to protect workers' rights.
And that's the bottom line in a lot of these filibusters. It's their blind faith ideology. It's not whether these are good or bad or people who know the job. It has nothing to do with their ability to do the job. It's just blind faith hatred of government.
And to me,
it's that simple. It's that they don't believe in government doing anything, so they're going to gum up the system so that it doesn't work. And then they turn around and say, see, we told you, it doesn't work.
Right. And that's exactly it. You know, they have spent, 3 years, creating chaos and uncertainty at the NLRB, and then they turn around and say, well, the board should stop functioning because of this uncertainty. I mean, the uncertainty was created by their hearings, their hundreds of requests for information, by their constant attacks on the board personnel, by their legal challenges to the board's rulemaking, to the board's decisions. This is, and finally to the president's recess appointments. This is what created the uncertainty in the first place. And then they have the gall to turn around and say, this agency should stop functioning, should stop enforcing workers' rights because of that uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much here. But let me ask you about the filibuster, because, you know, I had a bunch of people email me saying, yeah, they should do the nuclear option, blow that filibuster up. And I'm going, me personally, I'm like, well, hold on, because, you know, the Republicans will at some point take control, and they will railroad right over you. It doesn't matter. Should they have invoked it? Should we do something with the filibuster? Because I'm a firm believer that it should be the way that the movie says it is. Where if you want to filibuster something, you get your behind out on the floor, and you tell me why for 24, 48, for however long you can hold it.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders is still pushing for a real filibuster. And, you know, that's the way it should be, because, you know, that's the way it used to be. It used to be used in exceptional circumstances. And if you wanted to get up there and read the phone book because you were so appalled by civil rights legislation, you had to do that. And, you know, the American people had to be able to see you do that. And, you know, because of the cynical way in which the Republicans have misused the filibuster and misused the advice and consent function of the Senate, I think there's a very strong argument for, at a very minimum, saying that, you know, okay, if you're going to use the filibuster, you have to get up there and do a real filibuster.
I'm right there with you. You know, at the end of this, to me, that's the answer. And, you know, a lot of this other stuff, I gotta be honest, I was surprised, because when I read the reports this morning, of how it went down, it seemed like the Republicans capitulated. So do you think it's that they've realized that they've gone too far with this, and that the American people are waking up to the reality that a lot of the wheels of government that appear broken are kind of on purpose by them?
Yeah, no, I think that's entirely possible. I mean, you know, they know that, you know, if the truth emerges that, you know, that their strategy is simply to say no to anything and everything, you know, if it's really made known, you know, this sort of like cynical way that they're behaving, and, you know, that the real reason that, you know, they're opposing agencies like the NLRB and other critical agencies is not because of any concern about the qualifications of the people who are being nominated, but simply because they don't like the agencies and they don't like the work that these agencies do. I think they were worried that, you know, that ultimately that there would be a backlash. And it does appear, like, you know, to a certain extent, that they have capitulated, they have caved on the issue. As I said, it's ridiculous that Griffin and Block have to be sacrificed. They're, you know, very well qualified. We're doing an excellent job under the most difficult of circumstances. Ultimately, the important thing is that we have a functioning board that has a democratic majority, as is, was supposed to happen when we had a democratic president elected for the second time.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see that this went this way. Now, as you've said, there's a functioning board. It can get on with doing its work instead of, because I got to be honest with you, without a functioning board, you know, what happens to industrial peace? Which is the reason that it was created in the first place,
yeah,
was to have that industrial peace. And I've been saying maybe we should, you know, if there's no board, maybe you just take to the streets.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and they've also been guilty, you know, of spreading, you know, both Republicans inside of Congress and their proxies outside of Congress have been guilty of spreading, you know, the most cynical and you know, misleading misinformation and, you know, really outright lies about what's been happening at the board, and also what would have been the consequences of not having a board. You know, there was a piece written by a former Republican chair of the board the other day saying, you know, what's the big deal? It wouldn't matter if there's no confirmation of these appointments, that it would have no bad consequences for workers. They know this is not true. They know the reality, you know, and they have no qualms about misleading and lying the American public.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, John. A good day. This is a good day for the president. A good day for workers across the country. So I'm happy.
Great. Glad to be on.
All right,
thank
John
you.
Logan, our good friend, a professor from San Diego State University. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Representative Jim Himes says it's appalling. He was talking about the money that special interests stuff in the pockets of our lawmakers. It's disgusting, and it opens the possibility of conflicts of interest and corruption, he added. So, naturally, He promptly joined the disgusting system that has turned our capital into a wide-open bazaar for buying and selling legislative favors. It's unfortunately the world we live in, the Connecticut Democrat shrugged. Even though Himes is only in his third term, he's become an aggressive trader in this bazaar, heading up fundraising for his fellow Democrats in the U.S. House. Why him? One, as a member of the committee that oversees Wall Street, he can attract campaign cash like honey attracts flies, especially when big banks are lobbying furiously to get exemptions from legislation that restricts some of their destructive profiteering. Two, Himes has proven to be a trusted ally of the Wheeler Dealer bankers, supporting their dereg bills. And three, he's one of them, having been made a millionaire as a Goldman Sachs banker. Republicans are totally in Wall Street's pocket, but Democrats are sinking into it, too. With the admirable exception of Representative Maxine Waters and a handful of other Dems who stood with consumers, most Democrats on the committee joined every Republican member in May to do the bank lobby's bidding. 6 days later, Himes' fundraising operation arranged for the 7 freshman Democrats on the committee, each of whom had stood with the bankers, to trek up to the heights of Wall Street for a personal bonding session with the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. Thus are forged the ties that bind. This is Jim Hightower saying, hey, Democrats, don't just deplore this corrupt system. Stand with us to overthrow it. To learn how, go to www.publiccampaign.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Oh, yes, yes, the big companies have, they rule the roost. And I always think of that, the by the guy who was the CEO of Dow Chemical back in the 70s. Who said, you know, I don't want to be an American company. I want to be in every country, and I want to be beholden to no one. I want to be my own. I want to be in an island in the middle of the ocean and not have any allegiance to anyone. Just want to do business everywhere and, well, have no allegiance. Which is why I always love when these big multinational companies, they wave the flag and they wrap themselves in patriotism. I always love that. One of those things that, you know, just kind of cracks me up. Because at the end of the day, they don't give a tinker's damn about this country. What they care about profit. That's it. Care about the money. Show me the money. That's it. Bottom line. And, you know, I can't, all day long I've been thinking about the McDonald's Visa thing. And it just cracks me up that even they can't come up with a better lie than what they've come up with. And now as the annual thing that goes on, I guess yesterday they kicked off the McDonald's kicked off their Monopoly game. Cause you can go buy stuff and you can get, prizes. I guess they're like 602 million game pieces that will be in play. Though something like 135 million food prizes. 15 million instant prizes. You got, I guess, a 1 in 4 shot, about 25% chance of winning, which isn't all that great, to be honest with you. I think the lottery has got a better chance of playing the lottery. But, you know, it's coming out, so now you can go buy your stuff to get your game pieces. I hope they put more thought into that than they did this website. And the website really, you can't make this up. You really can't. You can't. You look at the website that they put out, and it goes through budgeting because their workers are evidently stupid because they work for them, right? And it goes through, you know, line by line your budgeting and you know, how much money you make. And right at the very beginning, it cracks me up that, you know, they admit right from the start that there is just no way that you are ever going to be able to
to make a living on a 40-hour paycheck at McDonald's. They have put your first job income of at $1,105, and then your second job, $955. So you're talking about about $150 difference between your first and second job. So you're talking probably like 75 hours a week. And then they're saying, well, $2,060 is what you have to live on. And what I've said, because if you look at that 2060 number, and I was thinking about this earlier, that 2060 number, that's an important number because that puts you above the poverty line. Because the poverty line for a family of four is just around 23,500. So if you're making $2,000 a month, you're over that poverty line, right? And to me, that's what one 40-hour job should pay. But you go through and you look at the expenses. You know, you have $600 for rent, $150 for a lemon of a car, car/home insurance, $100. Health insurance, and this is the part that just, again, along with zero budgeted for heating your apartment, $20 for health insurance. Where do you get health insurance for $20? I must have missed that. And they're saying that, you know, your monthly living expenses will be $1,200, and you'll have $800 to spend. And you could spend, you know, almost $27 a day. And you know what you could do? You could buy Happy Meals or, you know, food to win the little tickets. And I stop and I think about this. And this has actually gotten a lot of media play. Because this is so big that even the mainstream corporate-controlled media realizes what a farce this is. $20 a week. I guess McDonald's does offer some health insurance for like $20 a week. But there are these mini plans to where if you have anything that costs more than $10,000 in a year, sorry, you're done. You know, I look at this and I go, am I missing something? And you wonder why across the country you're seeing people saying enough already. And I've been saying for a long time, we need to make these jobs the middle class jobs of the future. But how long is that going to take? And, you know, as I talked about earlier, you know, with the restaurant we went to, how soon do they mechanize this whole thing? You know, I was just reading an article before the show on, you know, how quickly things are being mechanized. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, farm workers, you know, the farm workers are fighting to, you know, to make a couple of extra pennies. They're looking at making machines that will do all of the hand picking. So there'll be no need for migrant farm workers. I mean, why are we not having a conversation about what the future looks like for all of us? Because understand there aren't going to be enough jobs. And you know, as I said at the beginning of the show, the OECD, you know, they've come out and said, look, unemployment's going to get worse before it gets better. The next year, you're going to see more unemployment across the globe. 20 years from now, you know, as we continue to develop new technology, as we continue to get used to using the new technology, as at some point I'm going to have to, as much as I resist, as much as I put up a fuss, if I want to go to a restaurant and have dinner with my family, I'm going to have to probably get over my disdain for these screens, for these computers. I guess I'm just old. I prefer to actually talk to somebody. And I wonder, you know, once everything is automated and mechanized, will I still have to put a tip? Well, am I going to have to tip the computer? Just a thought. But I look at this plan and the website, and I encourage everyone to go take a look at the website. There's so much stuff here. It's practicalmoneyskills.com, and it's put together by McDonald's and Visa, which you go, you know, why would they somehow come together? Well, to be honest, you know, as I found on the website, they have pay cards. So instead of a paycheck, you get a little Visa card where they'll just keep filling it up, and you can access just like a Visa. We are now becoming a completely cashless society. This is the next phase. You know, I remembered, and I was one of the ones who bucked that trend as well, the direct deposit. It was only probably 10 years ago that I agreed, and it was basically one of those contractual things where we didn't have much of a choice. It was negotiated into the contract that everyone would be direct deposit. I was one of the holdouts. I still wanted the check. And we gave in on that, and well, maybe these cards, maybe they're next. Anyway, just a thought. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on around the globe. Quick break, right back.
Defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So it was today, back in 1945. It was 5:29 a.m., 45 seconds. In the AM, the Manhattan Project came to an explosive end. Yes, today was the day the United States conducted the very first test of the atomic bomb in a place called Alamogordo, New Mexico. And I think we were somewhere near there, fenced off, though, as we went on the big tour. Also today in history, George W. Bush unveiled the color coding system to make us all fearful of red, orange, and I don't know, purple, green, whatever the colors were at the time, where he announced that we're going to have a Department of Homeland Security. Yay. I miss the color coding. Anyway, here to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen,
well,
thanks for taking time for us.
The color coding sort of went away without big fanfare.
I miss the color coding because, you know, it's good. It's like that Pavlovian thing. You can scare the hell out of people. Going, it's red. It's orange. Run. Scare.
Right.
You miss it? Do you miss the color coding?
I do miss it.
I mean, because every time something would happen,
you could wake up and you could find out what you're supposed to feel that day.
Exactly. And it was just such a simplistic system. And to me, it really typified the Bush presidency. And, you know, on our labor history tour, we got to stop at the Bush Library, which was amazing. The greatest president in the history of civilization, or so the library tells you. And I've been saying this since I've been back. The one thing that really grabbed me the most is right when you walk into the library. Have you been there?
I've never been to either Bush Library.
Well, right when you walk in, there's this huge wall, like 20 feet high, like 50 feet long. The Wall of Freedom.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Wall of Freedom are all of today's robber barons who donated money to build. So you've got the Koch brothers, you've got, you know, the woman from Wisconsin, you know, all of the big wealth class of the country, their names in granite in the Wall of Freedom. And then for the poorer robber barons, for the poorer wealthy, there's the Registry of Freedom off to the side, and it's computerized, and you can scale through. But
the Wall of Freedom is just donors.
Yeah, it's just the big money donors. And they couldn't tell me because we got to interview one of the director of something. I should remember. But he didn't have a number. He didn't tell us how much it cost to get on the Wall of Freedom. And I wish I would have thought of it at the time to count how many times the word freedom was in the Bush Library.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Did they know you were coming?
Yeah, we told them in advance we were coming, and they took us into the Situation Room. Because I didn't know this. In 2007, they had completely redone the Situation Room. So the room where we watched Obama and Hillary Clinton and all the people...
had been redone.
Completely redone, new high tech. But the old one that was there since the Reagan years, Bush stole. I shouldn't say that. Bush took to his library and recreated, put in his library, and... we, as being special media people, got to go sit in the Situation Room. I got to sit in the chair where Donald Rumsfeld put his took us.
Oh, do you have your picture of it?
I do, actually. I mean, you can't, I mean, Bush aside, that's history. You know, I was in there with my daughter because we took her along, and it was one of those, you know, those father-son photo op things that, you know, no parent can pass over, right?
Right.
But I still did get
that's hilarious.
And we went and did he recreated the Oval Office, and my daughter went and took a picture behind the desk, because I'm hoping someday she'll be president so she can straighten this country out.
It needs some straightening out.
Oh, you know. But, you know, the library, to me, and this is way off topic of why I asked you to come on today, but really highlighted for me how simplistic the Bush presidency was. I got to be the decider. And you get 2 minutes to decide a crisis.
Oh, really?
Oh, it was hysterical. And you have, like, someone from the House, someone from the Senate, a taxpayer, a representative of the taxpayer, and they all give you their opinion. And while they're giving you their opinion, news breaks come in, news flash. You know, this has happened. Oh, my God, the sky's falling. You have to make a black or white decision. It's yes or no. And I'm going, you know, to me, that really signified what the Bush years were all about. Very black and white, very cut and dry, that everything is immediate, that... you know, the collapse that happened in 2008, to them,
yes,
just happened. It wasn't the result of 30 years of bad economic policy that could have been stopped in years prior, especially by him. No, it was immediate. It was a catastrophe. It was a crisis. It was, you know, almost like a natural disaster that had to be dealt with at that minute. And it really, for me, just signified the black and white part of it. And then my other favorite part was the Ouija board, the balance of power Ouija board. You could play the game and try and balance. They had a little triangle. I mean, it was really very hysterical. I suggest anybody who's in that area, who's in Dallas, go. It well worth it. I didn't pay. Fortunately, they let us in for free, but it's probably worth the $12 or $15 or whatever it was to get in just for the entertainment.
Wow.
Amazing. So let's get to it.
Yes.
Riots in the streets. Oh, my God, The people with the hoods on are going insane. At least that's what the media keeps telling me. Yet you find out there really haven't been any riots.
Well, right. I mean, the media seems to be playing this up. And, yes, Reverend Sharpton was in front of the Justice Department. And, yes, they are going to have these Trayvon Martin days on Saturday. But, honestly, I'm not sure... my view is that it should be, the goal should be, and I think it may be because I know Sharpton is doing a conference, to overturn some of these crazy laws.
Yep.
Statewide.
Yeah, in fact, I understand there's going to be a conference blocks away from where Martin was killed on the Stand Your Ground law. And to me, put aside what happened in the trial. You know, just put aside all of that. What the message to me is, and this is what scares the hell out of me. The message to me, when I was a kid, if I picked a fight with somebody and I got my butt kicked, my grandfather would say, good for you. You got your butt kicked. Did you learn a lesson? What this is telling me is I can pick a fight with somebody. If they kick the snot out of me, I have the right to shoot them. It doesn't get any simpler than that for me. All I got to say is I was afraid. Granted, I started it. Granted, I instigated it. But you know what? I'm afraid, so I shot him.
Right. I mean, there also needs to be education in the schools and everywhere else.
No, I think, Ellen, you know what I think we need to go back to? And this is one of those moments where I'm going to sound old. We need to go back to the school, to the sandbox, to the schoolyard, and kids need to fight again. They need to smack each other around and realize that, you know what? You don't do those things because someone's going to smack you. You don't confront somebody on the street and stick your finger in their face, and you don't do that without expecting there to be consequences. What we've done is we've allowed people to, I guess I'm allowed because of this ruling, I can go up and I can accost somebody on the street and yell at them and scream at them, and they have no recourse?
It really is quite amazing, and that is why I think the laws need to be changed. And hopefully that some of this energy can go to do that.
Yeah. Did you see, do you know who Lester Chambers is?
I do not.
He's one of the Chambers brothers. They sang that song back in the late 60s, Time. A great blues singer, in my view. I like the guy. Evidently, Saturday night, when he found out about the verdict, he said, you know, I'm going to dedicate this song to Trayvon Martin. And some crazy white woman, 42 years old, jumped up on the stage, pushed him to the ground, and was going to go start kicking him. And I took the position that, you know, now that this 73-year-old man was kicked to the ground, obviously he fears for his life. Could he have shot her?
Interesting.
I mean, is this where we're going with this? And this is why I think these laws...
Well, hopefully we're not.
And this is where I think these laws do need to be overturned. Look, there's common sense where if you're truly in fear of your life, that you've got to be able to defend yourself. But this is ridiculous.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, you know that, I mean, this concealed, the right is saying because of all these concealed weapons law, that's why Florida has less of this kind of stuff. Well, no, maybe there's other circumstances.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that there's got to be common sense. And, you know, you don't take the power out of the hands of the prosecutors and the juries by having these insane laws. I'm sorry. I mean, if you really are in fear for your life, you should be able to protect yourself. But I look at this case in Wisconsin where the guy said, and this is what blew my mind when I read this. This guy, 76 years old, thought the kid, this black kid, stole his guns. Confronts him in the driveway, in the street. Kid denies it. He shoots the kid dead. The police put his mother in the back of the cruiser, keep her there for an hour while her kid is dying on the street and in the hospital. They search the kid's house. They arrest his brother for a year-old truancy warrant. Find no guns, but the victim, the guy who's dead, the person they investigate.
Wow.
I mean, it's insane.
That is completely insane.
And what they're saying, what they're worried about is they're going, this guy's 76, white guy in Wisconsin, he might get away with it, given this. Anyway, let's move on. The nuclear option.
Hopefully Wisconsin is not Florida.
Well, as insane as this country's gone, nothing surprises me. A guilty verdict in Florida would have surprised me, to be honest, though. So the nuclear option, that off the table?
Well, it looks like it's off the table for now until there's more fights.
Right.
But basically, the president nominated two other people today. It looks like they obviously, because the nomination came so quickly, that they had already vetted those people with the Republicans, and that's what happened.
All right. So is this a capitulation by the Republicans, or is there some sweetener there that we don't know about?
Well, I think it's actually capitulation. I think they realized that they were not doing well and that this was going to bode poorly for them in 2014.
Well, I mean, that and a host of other things. I look at this farm bill and go, really? We're going to hand out tons of welfare?
Oh, the farm bill is unbelievable.
We're going to hand out tons of welfare to big agribusiness while literally taking food out of the mouths of poor children? Really? Is that the position they're taking?
It is. And it's interesting. Steny Hoyer today had a briefing, what he calls his pen and pencil briefings, because there's not allowed any video. And he basically said, hey, you know, I want to see how the Republicans vote on this.
Me too. And
so let them separate and let's see how they vote.
Yeah, but I saw this piece of research done by USPIRG that said that 74% of the subsidies in the farm bill go to 4% of the agribusinesses.
It looks like that's what is done, yes.
And you look at the amount of handouts that we give to these huge, massive, mega multinational corporations, and we say, sorry, poor kid, we're going to take a school lunch away from you. And I guess I just don't get it.
Well, I think what's going to happen is that these agribusinesses also, who do so completely well by the farm bill, et cetera, know that they're also going to do very well with food stamps, and I think they're going to start to really lobby.
Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, the food stamp money, doesn't that go right back to them?
It certainly does.
Nose, face, never mind. And finally, the Snowden thing.
Well, it looks like he's looking for temporary, something temporary in Russia.
Asylum, yes.
Apparently Snowden is not, Putin is not the only one that makes the decision, or so they say. From what I understand, Putin makes all the decisions in Russia, even if they say he doesn't.
Right. But they say he wants to go to South America, right?
That's right. And, of course, the Obama administration is saying, via their spokesperson, Jay Carney, well, that's, we're not embarrassed by this.
Of course you are.
Right.
But, you know, I look at this, and as I'm reading through this, is Snowden stuck in an airport like Tom Hanks was
No, because the airport lounge actually includes a hotel.
Oh, okay. Because I'm going, you know, is he walking around and showering in the bathroom?
No. I think there's actually a hotel there.
Do you think Putin's thrilled about this? Because some of
the
reports that I've read, he can't be happy about
it. No, he's not happy about it. He's sort of between a rock and a hard place.
And he blames us for basically scaring everybody else from even considering taking him. So
Right. They're
basically stuck with him.
They are.
Well, hooray. As Putin said, Merry Christmas. Ellen, it's great talking with you. It's great to be back. I appreciate you taking time for it.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. The most important issue.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but know they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth, sky.
Today, what causes the aurora borealis or northern lights?
Some Inuit believed the spirits of their ancestors could be seen dancing in the flickering lights. In Norse mythology, the aurora was a fire bridge to the sky built by the gods.
But science tells us the aurora happens because of the sun. Storms on the sun send gusts of charged solar particles hurling across space. If Earth is in the path of the particle stream, our planet's magnetic field and atmosphere react. When the charged particles from the sun strike atoms and molecules in Earth's atmosphere, they cause them to become excited.
Atoms consist of a central nucleus and a surrounding cloud of electrons. When charged particles from the sun strike atoms in Earth's atmosphere, electrons move to higher energy orbits further away from the nucleus. Then, when an electron moves back to a lower energy orbit, the atoms release light.
And that's what causes an aurora. What happens is similar to what happens in neon signs. Electricity is used to excite the atoms and gases within the glass tubes of these signs. That's why these signs give off their brilliant colors. Oxygen causes the color green. Nitrogen causes blue or red colors. The aurora works on the same principle, but at a far more vast scale.
For more, come to EarthSky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Earth, sky.
Today.
Yeah, you're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
This is the end. My only friend.
That never gets old. I mean, really, you hear that kind of hubris, that kind of ignorance, and it just never gets old for me. And, you know, as I was talking with Ellen there a minute ago, you know, our trip to the Bush Library really, really solidified for me the view that this is not a curious person. This is someone who the world is extraordinarily black or white. And, you know, as I was there walking through the Bush Library and Monument and Museum, which is a very weird, you know, when we talked to the guy who was one of the directors, or I forget what, the director of communications or whatever he was, what I thought was interesting was that there wasn't really a clear demarcation line in my view of what was the library, museum, whatever, archive, what was the part that was taken care of by the federal government, and what was the foundation, the policy part, because, you know, they still push for an agenda. And I guess I didn't get the question asked, you know, the Wall of Freedom, is that on the library side or is that on the foundation side? And you know, even the guy who, it's a murky kind of line. But what's interesting to me, and that's the amazing part. There's no clear demarcation line there. But the very simplistic views, they were very apparent. And if you get the chance, you got to go to the Bush Library to at least play the decider game. You go into this little room and there's a screen and they say, okay, pick which crisis, happened during the Bush years and you make the choice. And you got 2 minutes. It's like 2 minutes long. And, you know, they give you, you know, an advisor from the Senate, an advisor from the House, an advisor from the voice of the taxpayer. And while these three things are giving you their advice, they cut in with breaking news, this just happened, breaking news, and tons of interruptions, and then a very 24-like ticking bomb down, oh, you got to make a decision, hurry up, got to make a decision. And then, of course, you know, I was in, you know, one of the ones that I did was about the financial crisis, and I think virtually everybody in the room said, screw the banks. And out comes Bush, you know, on the little screen, waddles out on the screen and goes, well, I chose to bail the banks out, and here's why. Because I was the decider. And now you've been the decider. And very, very simplistic in that there were so many decisions that led up to that crisis, so many opportunities that were lost, so many opportunities missed, so many things that should have been done, so much policy, so many things that could have been done to avert that crisis. One of them was undo Graham Leach Bliley.
go back and reinstate Glass-Steagall, which I got to be honest, I don't know why the hell we haven't done it already. Why it isn't something we've done now. Because I think it's something we still need. This idea that we've pretty much given over all control of our economy to these big banksters is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But I look at this, and the only person, one of the only people I see talking about it is Elizabeth Warren, who last week introduced something to the State Banking Committee, or said at the State Banking Committee hearing that she was introducing the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act of 2013. Interestingly enough, you had John McCain as a co-sponsor, Maria Cantwell, and Angus King from Maine, who have said, you know, look, you know, the new bill, pretty much like the old one. A clear demarcation line between, you know, banking, the checking part, the lending part, from the investment part. Clear demarcation line. Undo, repeal the 99 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Now, understand, you know, Glass-Steagall had been being chipped away with for years, but Graham-Leach-Bliley kicked the walls out. And what you saw is you saw the big banks get so much bigger. And the graph that they put along with the story was amazing. Because what you saw is you saw, you know, the total assets of the top three big banks in the U.S. You saw their assets fluctuated between 10, maybe 15%, 10, 15% in that range, all the way up until, well, 1999 when the end of Glass-Steagall happened. And then 2000, it is a skyrocket to where the big three in 2009 controlled 40%. Of the total commercial banking sector. 40%. In just a decade. And boom! Here they are. They now are way too big to fail. And I remember, because I guess I'm old enough to remember the housing, the whole, the savings and loan scandal, where we had to bail them out because we allowed them to get too big, not too big to fail. We should have let them fail. That was a policy of, well, we need to bail out our buddies. This was, and, you know, some of the people who took the little Bush thing like I did said, well, you know, what would have happened? And we don't know. Would it have drawn down? Would it have pulled the rest of the economy down with us? Don't know. And, you know, the simplistic two-minute video sure as hell didn't help. But it's all of those policies. And I guess that's what really caught my attention about the Bush Library. It took slivers. And made them crisis. I mean, really, if you looked at if you didn't live through that era, you would think this was a guy who was just dealt a bad hand and he did the best he could. I look at it a little differently. I look at it as this is a guy who, through bad policy decisions, put himself in a lot of these situations. Now, you go back to the tax handouts of 2001. You go back to, I seem to be the only one who remembers that we were on pace to pay off our debt. And Alan Greenspan was pining and wondering, what is the country going to look like? What will we do when we're debt-free? Well, we didn't have to worry about that too long, thanks to George W. Bush. You don't hear much about that. You didn't see much of that in the library, though. There wasn't anything there on that. But there was the balance of power Ouija board game, which didn't work. As Brett, my producer, pointed out, didn't really work, was kind of broken. Heavily weighted to one side or the other, and it was hard to manipulate, and maybe that was part of the point. You know, maybe that's what they Or maybe that's what they gave George to play with while they were constructing the rest of the library. Don't quite know. Might be something worth asking a question about. But I took a picture and I showed someone at lunch the other day of the books in the Bush Library. And a couple of Dr. Seuss books, and it's kind of funny, haha, but it was a display about No Child Behind left. And I couldn't believe they let Dr. Seuss in the Bush Library. You know what wasn't there? The Pet Goat book, not there. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. And if you want to take a listen to our time at the Bush Library, the People's Tour for America is where you'd go to get the podcasts there. We're going to wrap it up for tonight. If you have questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Something I said got under your nerves. I got under your skin. If you liked it, rick@therickssmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous.